We're going to get started. I'm going to call the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee to order. We don't yet have a quorum, but Representative Slawick, if we could get you to present your bill and present the testimony, we can get started. The chair moves House File 1542. I don't have a quorum, so I can't move it. But when I do move it, we're going to move it to the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. So Representative Slawick, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know the members are still coming back in session, so we understand that. House File 1543 concerns background checks for child care workers. And members, I have talked with some of you about that it only concerns, in this committee, Section 8. And Section 8 is the probation officer and corrections agent part, and I have my witness here who will talk about that further.
Representative Slawick, when folks get here and we have a quorum, it's my understanding that you're going to move we're going to move the A1 amendment to delete the criminal background checks. Is that correct?
A1 specifically deletes the RAP back section, which is section 14. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Slawick. Please go ahead.
So, Madam Chair, as I was saying, this is a child care provider background check bill. There is a system in place right now, which is very important that this work is done and the background checks are done well. It is taking it from the counties doing it to the state doing it and be part of the BCA system. It would track providers who move from one county to another, which will make it easier. I do have Mr. Jerry Kerber here, who is from the Department of Human Services of Licensing, and he is going to be presenting in just a second. I can give you more information.
That's fine. We'll just wait for him.
Okay.
Mr. Kerber, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the Director of the Licensing Division at the Department of Human Services. And at the Department of Human Services and the Licensing Division is where we do a lot of background studies. We do about 1,000 a day. All under the requirements of Chapter 245C, there is the current situation is that while the Department of Human Services does all these background studies, there are some background studies that are done by counties under the same law, and some parts of that work gets transferred to DHS, the challenges to those disqualifications. And so what this bill is doing is kind of moving the background study portion of those responsibilities from the counties to DHS. And so the part of the bill here that Section 8, what that deals with is the language that's necessary if the background studies are not going to be repeated on a regular basis. One of the things that's happening right now at counties is when they redo background studies again and again and again on the same people to see if there's something new added to the record or if there's a new conviction that somebody engaged in who didn't have any before. So they're repeating background studies on these people either every year or every 2 years, and they're charging a fee for it. When the background studies under this law are done by the Department of Human Services, there is not a repeat of these background studies as long as people stay put where they've been employed or they're providing some kind of services. Instead, the language in Section 8 plays the role of making sure that the Department of Human Services is informed by the criminal justice system if one of these people commits a new crime. And so that's what's happening in Section 8, is that there had been an exclusion to that notification process related to family child care, and that exclusion is being removed so that when somebody's convicted of a crime, the corrections agent or probation officer now is finding out, does the person work in any programs licensed by the Department of Human Services or by the Health Department? Did they provide home care services? Are they in any way affiliated with a Human Services or Health Department licensed program? And if so, they notify us, except if it's family child care. So it's really just removing that exclusion so that those notifications would come to the department.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Slawick, we will just wait until there's a quorum, and then I will move your bill and move it on. So thank you, Representative Slawick.
Madam Chair, do we need to stay nearby?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Representative Slawick. Representative Olin or Mullery in the room? Representative Cole, could you present your bill? Representative Cole, we don't yet have a quorum, so if you would present your bill and we can take testimony when we have a quorum, we'll move it. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, House File 1962 is a bill that was brought to me by the Department of Corrections. It arose out of some conversations between the Department of Corrections and the and the various county groups. It does two things, Madam Chair. First, on page 1, line 20, it allows, it gives the judge the discretion in certain juvenile cases to order that probation supervisory duties be transferred to parents or guardians and take that burden in limited cases off of the county. Additionally, Madam Chair, in section 2 of the bill, there's a slight there was a slight oversight or error, if you will, on line 21, page 2, line 21. There was we inadvertently did not strike the word shall and insert the word may. You'll see that occurred on page 2, line 25. So I'd like to make that amendment, Madam Chair, and strike the word shall, insert may. What that would do, members, is it would make it would give the judge discretion in each case, depending on the circumstances, as to whether they need to, whether it's advisable to order a chemical dependency evaluation, and similarly, line 2.25, a mental health screening. So, members, that would be my amendment: strike shall, insert may on line 2.21.
When we have a quorum, we'll take care of it through the bill.
And Madam Chair, that's the bill. It's an effort to provide some relief, minimal relief, but some relief to county probation services in juvenile cases. And really all we're doing is we're giving the court the discretion to take these actions if in fact it makes sense in the particular case.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Coles, we will move it as soon as we have a quorum. Representative Olin or Representative Mullery in the room? Well, members, all we have left other than those two bills is my bill. So I certainly am happy to start walking through the Omnibus Public Safety Bill without objection.
Sorry. Madam Chair,
seeing that we don't have quorum, we can just begin going through it, and when we get quorum, you can go ahead and move it.
All right.
Members, we're going to be working off the DE2 amendment to House File 1303. And I'm just going to start walking through the bill. Article 1, Sections 1, 2, and 4 are Representative Bingham's House File 130, the social networking websites, keeping predatory offenders from accessing social networking websites. There will be an amendment about that one later to fix the fiscal cost. Article 1, Section 3 is time period clarified. That's House File 971. And this was a Department of Public Safety department bill. It clarifies the time period when there's a new offense or probation, parole, supervised release, or conditional release violation prior to the end of a person's predatory registration expiring. Article 1, Section 5, is also electronic devices that are prohibited. Also, Representative Bingham's bill, which is House File 129. Article 2, Section 1 is crime victims, information on orders for protection, which was also a department's bill, House File 1349. Article 2, Section 2, was Representative Rosenthal's bill, the domestic abuse arrest time expanded. That was House File 1273. It changes it from 12 hours to 24 hours. Article 2, Section 3 through 6, is Representative Tamar's Domestic Fatality Review Team, House File 248. Article 3, Section 1 and 10, is the 4th Judicial District Court location for Hennepin County, which was my bill, House File 1397. Members, Article 3, Section 2, is House File 1156, which is Representative Tamar's referee bill. We did not hear that yet in our committee, but Representative Tamar will be making a presentation today to let members know what that is, so we can have every item in our omnibus bill have had a hearing. Article 3, Section 3 through 6, is the public defender representation provisions. That was House File 509, and members, the language is slightly different than when we heard it. Apparently, there was an issue that was worked out between the public defenders and Representative Liebling. So note, there's a slight difference. Article 3, Section 7 is Investigative and Expert Services for Public Defenders. It was Representative Bingham's bill, House File 1145.
Representative Hilton, I'm going to interrupt you to let you know we do have quorum.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I think I'll finish walking through.
Right. I just wanted to announce that we do have quorum.
Once we do that, then maybe we'll move those other bills on their way, and then we can start doing that. Your committee, Madam Chair, would everyone do? Next is Article 3, Section 8, Pre-trial Filing Transcript, which was Representative Simon's, House File 212. Article 3, Section 9 is the Driver's License Reinstatement Diversion Pilot, which is Representative Lesh's 589. Article 4, Section 1 is Aggravated Sentence Departure Factors, which was my House File 1235. Article 4, Section 2 was the Correctional Facility Surcharge, which was Representative Cass, House File 1162. Article 4, Section 3 is County Authority and Detention Orders Clarified, which was my House File 1301. Article 4, Section 4, as well as Article 5, Section 6, was Representative Nelson's House File 1791, which is Joint Powers, Police Officers, Correctional Employees, what happens when things are combined. Article 4, Section 5, was Representative Kelly's House File 1021, regarding arrest and escape from custody. Article 4, Section 6 and 7 is Representative Bingham's House File 1144, which was regarding juvenile reports for the sentencing guidelines. Article 5, Section 1 was the mess precursor laws, which was my House File 145. Article 5, Section 2 is the Financial Crimes Oversight Advisory Board. This is Representative Bingham's House File 1422. Article 5, Section 3 is Representative Cass, House File 1120, which is regarding Cybris. Article 5, Section 4 is Recalled Toys, which is Representative Sanders, House File 166. Article 5, Section 5 was Representative Johnson's House File 1043, which is a public employment and criminal records. Article 5, Section 7 is Assault on Utility Employees, which is Representative Mullery's House File 67. Article 5, Section 8 is my House File 1264, which was trespass in areas cordoned off by police officers. Article 5, Section 9 through 11 is Representative Tamar's Post Board Powers and Duties, House File 366. And Article 5, Section 12 is House File 180, which is Representative Tamar's non-licensed peace officers. And Article 6, Sections 1 through 19 and 22 through 27 is the BCA Organizational Change, which is Representative Cass, House File 1119. And Article 6, Sections 20, 21, and 27 is Representative Rosenthal's House File 1274, which is the statewide radio board. And, Madam Chair, I would not like to do the amendments until after we hear the other two bills for the members that are on this committee, because two of those items, I believe, are going to be offered as amendments to this bill.
Sounds good, Madam Chair. Any questions for Representative Hillstrom at this moment? Okay, then it is my understanding that maybe we would have Representative Olin. Doesn't he have a bill?
Yes, Representative Olin has a bill, as well as, Madam Chair, we need to move Representative Flowers' bill.
Okay.
And Representative Cole's bill that we've already heard.
Okay. Representative Cole, maybe you want to move your bill?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I would move House File 1962. Be recommended to pass, and I'm not sure what we're Senate Finance. With a recommended referral to Public Safety Finance.
Okay.
And then, Madam Chair, I would move an oral amendment on line 2.21, strike the word shall, and insert the word may, which we discussed when I presented the bill. Happy to do so again if members have questions, but I'd move that amendment.
Okay. Any questions to the amendment? Get it in the form that the author wanted. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, could we repeat the line? And the
Representative Cole, maybe you could repeat it for Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, page 2, line 21, strike the word shall, insert the word may.
Any other questions on the amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. All right, amendment is adopted.
I'd renew my motion that House File 1962 as amended be recommended to pass, referred to the Finance Committee with a further recommendation to be sent to the Public Safety Finance Committee. A mouthful, but that's my motion.
Sounds good. Any questions to the bill as amended? Okay. All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I would move Representative Flowers' House File 1543 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee with a recommended re-referral to the Early Childhood Policy and Finance Division.
All right.
And I would also move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Any questions on the A1 amendment? We did previously hear this. All right. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Right. Representative Hillstrom, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I renew my motion that House File 1543 be recommended pass, be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to, as amended, to the
Early Childhood
Finance.
Finance.
I did. Let me read it. I renew my motion that House File 1543, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended re-referral to the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division.
Any questions? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Representative Olin. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Olin?
Yes, I'll move House File 1442.
And that's to be laid over for possible inclusion?
That's correct.
All right.
House File 1442 occurs by an incident that occurred in Hennepin County. Today with me is the brother of the person that was killed, the sergeant who was the supervisor of the police officer that was killed, and David Brown of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I'll turn it over to them.
Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
My name is Ann Deneen. I'm sorry. My name is Ann Deneen, and good afternoon, Madam Chair. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, again, my name is Ann Deneen. I'm the Middle 5th Street Sergeant with the Minneapolis Park Police. First and foremost, I'm here today to thank Representative Olin for sponsoring this bill and for Representative Hillstrom and members for hearing this bill in today's committee. On behalf of my department, the Park Police, friends and co-workers of Mark Bedard, we are truly grateful. On November 1st, 2007, Officer Mark Bedard was fatally injured during a foot pursuit in Minneapolis. Mark was chasing two suspects who were involved in two separate drive-by shootings that day. Mark collided with a squad car and died as a result of his injuries on November 9th, 2007. The two offenders whose actions set into motion the events that led to Officer Bedard's death were charged with and pled to felony drive-by shooting. Their sentences were less than 4 years each, including supervised release. The current flee on foot statute does not address possibilities of serious harm or death to others if pursuit of a felonious criminal goes from vehicle to foot. It is our request that you consider this proposed legislation where there's no harm. You keep the distinction between a fleeing felon in a motor vehicle and a misdemeanor fleeing on foot. Where the fleeing causes harm, it now provides the same penalty against the person fleeing, regardless of whether they are fleeing in a vehicle or on foot. I'd like to thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members, for giving your time and consideration to this statute.
Thank you for your testimony. Next testifier, Representative Bolden.
Mr. Bedard. My name is Mike Bedard. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it. Like I said, my name is Mike Bedard. Mark was my big brother, my best friend. As Sergeant Deneen stated, he was killed in November 2007 while chasing a suspect who had just committed a drive-by shooting. The reason I'm here today is to talk about how this has affected my family and the perspective of my family and how we believe this proposed law will help future victims and families deal with a difficult situation. It's been a very frustrating time for my family. The people that my brother was chasing, if they were still in the vehicle when he was killed, they would have been charged and held accountable. But because they crashed and ran on foot when he was killed, they weren't charged. In my opinion, it shouldn't matter if the person is in a vehicle or if they're fleeing on foot, they cause the same harm. I realize there's nothing that I can do to bring my brother back. However, the unfortunate reality is at some point another person will be killed or seriously injured as a result of a person's decision to flee on foot. At a minimum, we feel this law would help provide future families some sense of justice and hopefully ease their pain. It is not our goal to lock up every person that runs from the police. Our goal is to simply close a loophole to help protect police officers and citizens. Thank you again, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Olin, the next testifier.
I'll call David Brown, Hennepin County Attorney's Office.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I will echo the comments of the other testifiers and thank both the chair and the committee members for hearing this. When Officer Bedard was killed, the two men that the officers were chasing had committed a drive-by shooting near school. In fact, they were suspected in another one that had happened near the same time. So very serious offense. The frustration of prosecutors was that we were unable to prosecute them for the actual death of Officer Bedard, not because their conduct wasn't dangerous, but because at the actual moment that he was killed, they had crashed their car and fled. I'm sure if you asked, you'd find from Sergeant Deneen that we have a number of occurrences now, particularly in Minneapolis, where suspects are leaving their cars rolling as they bail out of the car. We had an incident last year, I believe, in Minneapolis, where that car crashed into a house and exploded. Now, no one was hurt, so nobody was charged there, but the kind of dangerousness we're talking about with these fleeings is significant. And as Mike Bedard pointed out, what we're trying to do here is close a loophole in the statute that will allow us to recognize and to hold accountable those who set in motion a very dangerous series of events. Thank you very much for hearing this bill, and we hope you will give it the most serious consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lesh, you have a question.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brown, I understand why the current statute as it is doesn't permit the felony charging, but how is it, and not being one who prosecutes murder cases, Why couldn't you proceed under the felony murder rule? Or if not, what was the decision, if there was a decision, that would sever that nexus?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, you ask a great question. The key moment in time here was the fact that they had bailed out of the car, because at that moment, under the current statute, you will recognize that it was no longer a felony. That is, they were no longer fleeing in a motor vehicle. And even though common sense tells you that, well, they set in motion that course of conduct, it should be felony murder, it occurred, it did not actually occur while they were committing a felony. And that was the tricky part here. And whatever lesser charges we could have issued were obviously much less serious than the drive-by shooting.
And if I may,
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. My recollection of felony murder from law school was that it merely needed to be foreseeable, and it permitted prosecutions for felony murder up to 24 hours after the initial felony. So is what you're telling me that the only incarnation of the felony murder rule in Minnesota for this situation was the actual flee in a motor vehicle statute that we have that's inadequate? And if so, why wouldn't we just impose an entire felony murder rule in general rather than limit it to just the flee on foot?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I will do my best to answer the question. I will tell you that the prosecutor who actually reviewed this case, Peter Orpett, former Assistant Attorney General and one of our most experienced homicide prosecutors, reviewed all of those very carefully, and what we were taught in law school is felony murder isn't actually the case in Minnesota. We have, both by court decision and some of our statutes, a much more narrow, and I will tell you that it was his opinion that we were not able to proceed under those theories, and without going into the details of that here for the committee, I will simply tell you that Mr. Orpett, if it could have been charged, and I think Mr. Bedard and Sergeant Denise would concur that if it could have been charged, Mr. Orpett would have done it.
Representative Olin, would you like to comment?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a quick comment. The intent of this law is not to get to fleeing on foot as a crime itself and making that a felony. The intent is only to get the motor vehicle, when the guy leaves the motor vehicle and something happens because of the fact there was a fleeing going on with the motor vehicle in the first place. It's a very limited area we're trying to cover, and I tend to agree with the Hennepin County attorney who wouldn't prosecute under felony murder, and having been a former prosecutor, I don't think the statute is fit.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, whoever would like to answer. You made the comment about somebody getting out of a car and the car going into hitting a house. I mean, if somebody did that, even if they weren't in the middle of a pursuit, what would happen to them? If somebody just got out of their car, it hit into a house. And I think there was something on the news last night where some people were actually in a car that hit the house and didn't give an explanation as to why. Yeah. What happens to those people?
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative Mason, that all depends on what they were doing before they jumped out of the car, obviously, and what level of damage was caused. It could be anything from a criminal damage to property, depending on who was hurt. It could be a civil liability. But particularly what we're seeing in the context of these fleeings is it's not just what's happening in front of the car that is fleeing. If you can think about these people taking off in a high-speed chase or in a high-speed fleeing, everybody thinks about what's happening in front of them and the people they crash into. The real dangerousness here is not just that, but what it requires from law enforcement. You have drive-by shooters, the kind of response we get is in and of itself dangerous, and then they're bailing out of these cars. Sometimes it crashes into a tree, sometimes it's a house, sometimes it's the, you know, you worry about the kid leaving there, and what we don't want to have is those kinds of loopholes where merely by jumping out of the car, they jump out of trouble. We're not after the flea on foot, you know, the typical run-of-the-mill, and I think the statute was explicit to leave that as a misdemeanor. It is only where harm occurs as a result of that fleeing.
Representative
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Brown, I, without seeing the rest of the statute, I guess I'm still having trouble on, since you have a semicolon, everything up to the semicolon on line 111 talks of the motor vehicle, and then you have a semicolon, then you speak of the other, and it seems to me like you're saying there had to be some relation to a car at some point. But this doesn't seem to have, it seems to me you're breaking the two parts to this by the semicolon, and you've got no connection to an auto in the second part. That maybe I'm missing something. Can you show me how that?
Yeah, Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I believe the intent here was to bring the definition of fleeing into one single definition. There are some that occur in a motor vehicle, some that do not. But where harm occurs, it applies to all fleeing.
Oh. So you do? Okay.
Representative Mullery.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. So it does apply to all fleeing, not just that they may be coming from a car or someplace or whatever.
Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair. Representative Mullery, that's correct as drafted. Now, to the extent that we need language that would limit it to people who are leaving a vehicle, we are more than willing to work with any members that would want to narrow it that way.
Whoa. Okay. Madam Chair, and I just...
Representative Mullery, you do have one more bill, which is yours.
Okay. Mr. Brown, I don't have a particular feeling either way. It was just the way you were presenting it doesn't seem to be the way that it's actually written, but that's okay.
Just a quick comment on that. The intent of the bill is to cover only the leaving the motor vehicle situation. I realize the wording may not be the perfect wording. That may be a question. That's the problem.
Any other questions? Okay, and then Representative Olin, would you like to renew your motion?
I'll renew my motion to lay it over.
Okay. Is there anybody, I should ask, is there anybody that would like to testify on House File 1442? Okay, Madam Chair. Yeah, Representative Hilton.
Representative Olin, it's my understanding that you're going to be offering this amendment to the bill in just a little
bit.
And so if there is some language that you need to fix, y'all might want to start working on it.
Yeah, I realize it.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Then, Chair Lato. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
House File 1224. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House File 1224. For possible inclusion in the...
Proceed with your bill.
Should we just go ahead?
Proceed with your bill. Yep.
Madam Chair and members, Minnesota's been working on the juvenile justice discrimination issue since 1974. But in 1988, Congress passed some work on this and wanted core protections in the states, and the states have to identify and address the disproportionate representation of minority youth within the juvenile justice system, and yet Minnesota still doesn't have a clear policy statement on this issue. The Minnesota Judicial Council and other state agencies each have their own, and they're all different, so we're trying to get one in statute that represents the state position on this. We are at the top of the list of states with the greatest disparities between Caucasian and minority youth. For instance, African American youth accounts for 28.7% of juvenile arrests, yet they're only 6% of the youth population. And with me today we have people from that actually work on the head of the council, the JJAC is what it's called. And I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but they'll introduce themselves.
Okay. Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard Gardell, I'm Chair of the Minnesota Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. I would just say a couple of things around this issue. We think it's extremely important to set a policy around this issue because most of the evidence shows that when a disproportionality occurs, that is that people of color are overrepresented in the system, generally, that can be addressed through looking at decision points within the system. And there's a lot of good work in Minnesota being done around that now, some detention reform, some the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative. JJAC is having a conversation with some counties in the 9th Judicial District about some detention reform pieces. And we're also in conversation with practitioners about some other innovative strategies. But I think it's important for all those conversations to move forward that the state has a clear policy on this, a clear indication of what our values are and what our policy is around that particular issue. I would also add that it's a very important piece for demonstrable action to the feds. We participate under the Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention Act. We get funding that funds a lot of youth-serving programs in Minnesota. In the last, over the last 10 years, about $36 million. We need to continue to address this issue in order to be, continue to be eligible for those fundings and not take penalties. And one of the demonstrable actions is for the state to have a policy on this issue. So that's why we're in front of you today asking for that.
Okay. Representative Cole.
Chair, to the witness, have we lost funding thus far because we don't have a policy statement?
Madam Chair, no, we have not lost funding to date, but I think that is not necessarily a guarantee that it won't happen in the future. I also want to say that I think it's, you know, despite the, well, yeah, no, we haven't lost funding at this point.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm contemplating an amendment that, you know, we like mom and apple pie and other things. I mean, I don't want to make light of this, but to me, we're putting something in the statute that, well, of course the state supports eliminating barriers to racial, ethnic, and gender fairness within the criminal justice system and everywhere else. So I'm not sure why it's just somewhat meaningless. We're not losing funding. We haven't lost funding. We maybe someday possibly might lose funding, so we're going to put some statement into the statute books that I don't know why we spend our time and effort doing these things sometimes.
Just to that point, Madam Chair, and I understand and recognize Representative Cole's point, and also he, of the same philosophy, didn't like the purpose statement in the proposed bill last night, and I kind of feel him a little bit on this. However, at the same time, I think this is being proactive because it is the feds who did this, and it's the feds who are looking for this kind of thing, and I think it's probably responsible to get in front of the eight ball rather than behind it on this, and these folks have put the work into it, so I am supporting it.
Okay. Any other questions, comments from the committee? Any other comments from your testifiers, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, First Alliance says identify and eliminate barriers. I came in late. I was with a constituent. I'm just wondering what specific we're talking there. Just those four words: identify and eliminate barriers. What are we talking about,
Mr. Garden?
Madam Chair, first of all, let me say that the policy that is in front of you is a policy that's existed for the Judicial Council, the judicial branch of the state, for many years. So that language has been around for a while. It's not something that we just created. We took it from the Judicial Council. It basically, I think, refers to strategies that have been looked at that I mentioned before, that look at decision points within the system and look for disparate treatment. And if there is some disparate treatment that can be identified, then it looks at strategies to address those particular disparate treatments. And if there isn't disparate treatment that can be identified, then obviously it looks for the barrier, and there isn't a barrier, and we move on to a different issue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, are we doing that already?
Garden.
Hi, it's Gardell.
Gardell, I'm sorry.
No, I'm thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would have to say no to that in several areas. And But I also think that there's a lot of good work that's being done with regards to that, and I just think this is a good leadership statement for the as a policy for the state of Minnesota.
Okay. And Mr. Gardell, I'm sorry, my name doesn't have an N in it either, but I answered to both of them.
That's okay.
any other questions or concerns? I know you'd like that, Representative Cash. All right. Anyone in the audience that would like to testify on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Mueller, would you like to renew your motion?
Yep, Madam Chair.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh, whoops. I'm sorry. I'll lay it over. Thank you. Members, the committee has already heard testimony on a couple bills, and the committee will limit itself to procedural action today on two of these. The first one is House File 582, Representative Lesher's bill.
Yes.
Members,
if I could just address that a minute.
Yes. Members, this is one of the items that was up for the omnibus bill that didn't make the cut, and so we are sending it on its own. So I would move that House File 582 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative West.
I appreciate all your support, and if everyone I talk to is on the same page, then we should be fine. So please support my bill.
Any other questions, comments? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
You went, right?
Huh? Where did it go?
It went to the General Register.
Thank you.
I will move that House File 570 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the General Register. Members, this is the Representative Champion bill regarding rest area activities. Member. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, members. Again, this is another one that didn't make the cut on the Public Safety Policy Committee. This is a department bill, and so we're sending it on its own.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, you're sending it where? To the General
Register?
To the General Register.
If I could make a question, did they get that part fixed in the bill about that they could do whatever they want or make up their own mind on what activities were granted or not? Did they do any... in that language? Anybody here?
Madam Chair.
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Cornish, MnDOT came and spoke with me about the bill. They were very gracious with their time and interested in working further on the legislation, but I don't believe any amendments have been drafted yet. I didn't ask specifically for any amendments. I just expressed my concerns with the bill to them.
Madam Chair, that I can just wait, I guess, to the floor, but this the concern I expressed in this bill was they'll be able to decide on their own complete prerogative if any activity is granted or not, whether you can play baseball or badminton or this or that. It'll be case-by-case basis, and I just have my worry about that, some inspector showing up and say this isn't allowed. So I guess I'll talk to them between now and the floor then.
Okay. Any other questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Division.
You don't know.
All the
majority rule.
What's that?
Motion carries.
Okay.
Then
division.
Division.
You call division.
Yeah. All right. All those in favor say aye.
Raise your hand.
I'm sorry. Raise your hand. Opposed? I need to go to my ear doctor. Does not pass.
Okay,
then Representative Hilstrom, I believe we're prepared to proceed with your omnibus bill. Members, we have already walked through the bill, and so with that, I would move that House File 1301 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register. And then, Madam Chair, I would move the DE2 amendment. Okay, to your amendment. Madam Chair, I have already walked through the DE
Yes.
You have walked through the DE2 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that there is a section in the bill that relates to volunteer instructors for firearms, hunters, and trapping and motorized vehicle training. So if the staff could look through whatever section that might be, and we'll delete it.
Okay, can Representative Hillstrom, if it's okay, do you want to begin with some of the other amendments while staff works diligently on that?
That would be great.
Okay, the chair offers the A1 amendment, and that is the bill we heard earlier this week regarding taking the federal law for codifying the federal law for pharmacy drugs and putting it into state statute, which allows for more due process, and we voted positively on it. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Sure. Madam Chair, before we do that, I don't think we voted on the DE2 amendment. Do we have that in front of us yet or not? I'm confused as to where we're at.
We should vote on the DE2 amendment, Madam Chair.
I apologize.
I understand that it's in the packet. We haven't voted on the DE2 amendment.
I
want to make sure that we put Representative Hillstrom's bill together properly.
I'm sorry.
So we don't have to come back and do it again.
I apologize. All those in favor of the DE2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Now I will offer, the chair will offer Representative Corning.
To save staff some time, I think it's page 38, Article 4, Section 2, if you're looking for that, those items you were looking for.
Okay.
Right.
Representative Corning, if you could clarify that again, please.
Page 38, Article 4, Section 2 of the DE2. What's that?
Is
it Article 4?
Is that the only place, Representative Cornish, that you can find? Representative Cornish.
That's so far what I've found to do with...
Okay. So, members, I do have an intention to delete every single section that has to do with the game and fish and forestry. Representative Bill is quite upset that I'm not hearing his game and fish bill, and so he has requested my bill be passed on to his committee. So I'm just going to delete the sections, and whoever bills they happen to be, take it up with Representative Bill.
Representative Cornish.
And we will delay the fight every day from here to the floor, and on the floor. Thank you.
Representative Cornish. Kellogg, sorry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It looks at Representative Cornish, I don't know if you identified sections 3 and 4 as well. I don't know if staff has gotten through this yet and has the amendment or not, but I want to, you know, Representative Hillstrom, I don't have a problem with those provisions. I understand it's your intent to take them out, and that's, you know, that's fine. We can have that, as Representative Cornish said, we can have the fight another day. I see it in sections 3 and 4 as well, I think.
We're going to take that up at the end.
All right.
So it's my understanding that Representative Taft is part of the BCA's section, so it is a department bill that will be taking it out. So Representative Taft, the staff will be going through the BCA's policy provision one section at a time, and we will be taking those provisions out of the bill.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, can I proceed with my amendment?
Please, Madam Chair, if you certainly could explain again which amendment we're on.
Thank you. For the third time, I will move the A1 amendment, and that is the bill regarding the codification, I will sum it up, of the federal law with the state law, requiring that any changes to the federal statutes with our pharmacy drugs and their scheduling be brought forth every year as a technical bill so we can codify that into state law. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Mullery, would you like to move the A2 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the ATM meeting.
If you could speak into the microphone and proceed with the
amendment. Sorry, Madam Chair. Yes, I'll move the A2 amendment.
Okay.
That's the bill we just ended up discussing.
Just wanted to, you know, as folks, as we go through this, if you want to briefly say what it is. Okay. All those in, any questions? All those in favor say, Madam Chair, do you have any comments on the amendment?
I have no opposition to the amendment.
Okay. And I apologize. I should have asked you that on mine, too. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Representative Mullery, would you like to move the A3 amendment?
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll move the A3 amendment. And should I explain it?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, this is just so that I believe what this would do is takes all of Representative Hillstrom's language and it just changes the 3 years to 5 years that they keep the records, because in a lot of the important drug cases, we use the federal prosecutors and offices, and they have a 5-year statute of limitations. The Attorney General and some other county attorneys have also told me that in prosecuting conspiracy cases, they can go back more than 3 years. So this would just conform to the statutes of limitations and the way they're used by the prosecutors in getting at these drug cases.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, do you have an opinion on the amendment?
I'll leave it up to the body, Madam Chair.
Okay. All those in favor say aye. Oh, Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, if Representative Mullery would, I don't know if you know Representative Mullery, but have you talked to the pharmacists or the retailers? Are there concerns about extending this? I had some concerns about the original proposal, but not enough to, you know, make me try to take it out of the bill. But
Representative Cole, until I believe Representative Hillstrom is now on the Gang and Drug Oversight Council. I was on that, and they worked with the representatives of the pharmacies. The pharmacies didn't care about this at all. They didn't want us to go to the South Dakota form, which requires them by electronic means to send all the lists into one database at the state. That was their one thing that they didn't want. They didn't care about this.
Representative Cole? Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. Motion carries. Representative Coles, the A4 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move the A4 amendment. Members, this would delete the Nelson bill from the omnibus bill. Members, I share the concerns of the correctional officers and peace officers across the state of Minnesota as we talk about consolidation and merger, but I also don't think that it's appropriate for us to be taking items off the bargaining table. This is an effort, I believe, to take something that should be discussed at the bargaining table between labor and management off of the table. And while I absolutely support the direction, and I would hope that that's the result that we would see as labor and management negotiate any consolidation that may happen in the future, I'm concerned about taking those issues off the bargaining table. So, Madam Chair, that's my motion. I'd appreciate member support.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom, comments on the A4 amendment?
I would ask members to vote no.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. Chair offers the A5 amendment. Members, this is to the Predator Offenders in Facebook. Came back with a fiscal note, and so this amendment just pertains to, keeps the bill intact, but only lets it pertain to those on intent supervised release and takes away the fiscal note. Would appreciate your support. Any questions? All those in favor, any comments on the A5 amendment?
If we don't get rid of the fiscal note, we have to go to finance. So please support Representative amendment.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. prevailed. The A6 Amendment, Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I move the A6 Amendment. The A6 Amendment addresses the public spender reimbursement, and right now the language in the bill would provide 100% reimbursement to Hennepin County. As we heard testimony, Hennepin County does not pay the full cost of the public spenders. So like other, they certainly have a higher cost in Hennepin County than other parts of the state, but Madam Chair, I would move the amendment. It would have two-thirds of the reimbursement. I want to make sure I'm at the right spot here, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
That two-thirds of the reimbursement be returned to Hennepin County and one-third go to the state.
Okay, sounds good. Representative Hilstrom, do you have any comments on that?
I would ask for members to vote no.
Okay, Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, I was here when that deal was made, and as part of the consolidation, that was the deal to keep that. So this would be contrary to the deal the state made with Hennepin County at the time.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mullery, I don't recall, I don't know that, I was not here when that deal was made, and we heard testimony that Hennepin County certainly bears more of a cost than other parts of the state for the public defender system, but they don't bear all of the cost. That was a testimony we heard in committee earlier this year, and so it doesn't seem to me fair to the rest of the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota that Hennepin County receive all of the reimbursement when the taxpayers are, in fact, picking up part of the bill for the public defenders in Hennepin County. So, Madam Chair, I'd appreciate member support.
Okay. And if Representative Tamar.
Well, maybe Representative Muller didn't know the answer to this, but the way I understood that the final negotiations were when the with Hennepin County was that any new public defenders would then be state
right.
public defenders. So all were
exactly
what you have is a number of public defenders who were sort of grandfathered in under. That those folks would all be lost under your amendment, Representative. If I remember the agreement correctly, and I was here,
Madam Chair,
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, I want to be respectful to Chair Hilstrom, to Representative Mullery, and Chair Paymar. I want to explore this issue a little further. This may show up as an amendment on the floor, but at this point, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Okay, thank you, Representative. A6 amendment is withdrawn. Representative Mullery to the A7 Amendment. This is the bill we heard last night.
Madam Chair, this is the bill from last night. I'll move the A7 Amendment so that we can try to get at the dogfighting. And you just heard it last night, so I think everybody remembers it.
Yep. Any questions? All right. All those in Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mullery, I did make an effort to reach the animal control officer to try to get some language and have not heard back. I still find this language problematic and certainly going to vote against the amendment, but I'd like to be able to get language in that covers my concerns.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Mullery.
I have no problem with working on the language on its way to the floor. I happen to think, and I talk to prosecutors, that don't think there will be any problems, also defense attorneys, because they're used to this type of language. You can't be specific. But if there, my understanding is Mr. Streff, who's the lead animal control officer in the state, said he would try to work with language, but in the last apparently half a day they haven't been able to reach each other and work it out.
Okay. Representative Hilstrom, do you have any comments on this?
I have no issue with the amendment. Vote yes.
Okay. Did you have something else?
No.
Okay. Any other questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Owen to the A8 amendment.
Madam Chairman, what I would like to do at this stage is procedurally change what we're doing. I think we should bring this up at the end because I got to move to reconsider because it probably should go to finance. I don't think there's a cost, but I never established that. I've got some amended words to use.
Okay.
at the end, but I think we shouldn't do it in the middle of this omnibus discussion. We should get this done first.
And Madam Chair, it would be my intent to permit Representative Olin to retake up his bill, and we would send it to finance to make certain that it could make it to represent Tamar's in the event there's a fiscal note. So if Representative Olin would withdraw the A8 amendment, we could be fine.
So done.
Okay. Thank you. We'll just tuck that away for later time. Somebody have the A10 amendment. Representative Cole?
Madam Chair, it's not mine, but I'd be happy to offer it. Representative Anderson, was it yours? Okay. Madam Chair, I'd offer the A10 amendment. I believe this is Chairman Smith, I'm hearkening back to a few years ago. Representative Smith's bill, I believe the Department of Corrections came and testified in support of this bill, and I'd offer it at this time. I don't believe there's any controversy, or maybe I'm Chairman Tamar is looking quizzically at me. I want to...
Madam Chair, is this the We Really, Really Mean It amendment? Yes, this is current law, and it's my understanding. I did receive an email that they have written this down to zero, Representative Tamar. So in the event that this is not, you know, when we actually get the certified copy, we'll just delete it.
And Madam Chair, it would be my intention as well to support an amendment to take this out if there is a fiscal cost so that we don't have problems with Chair Paymar.
Okay. All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Johnson to the A11 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer that amendment. This was heard last night in committee, and again, in sum, what it does is it directs the DOC's Minnesota Information and Supervision Services Committee, which is already established, to undertake an assessment of the use of evidence-based practices for community supervision, which is probation, parole, and supervised release. And that report is due in 2011 rather than 2010, again, so that a fiscal note isn't required.
Okay. I'm fine with it, Madam Chair. Okay. Any other questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Johnson to the A12 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move the A12 amendment, which was also heard last night. And again, what that does is clarifies that those placed on court-ordered probation or pretrial release submit to compliance checks. This is a standard procedure already in place, so we want to put in the state statute just for clarification purposes.
Okay, Madam Chair, do you have any comments on the A12 amendment?
I support the A12 amendment.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A13 amendment, Representative Hilton.
Madam Chair, the A13 amendment is the specialized emergency response team that we heard, and so I would ask for member support.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. All right. Motion fails. I will move the chair moves the A14 amendment. This bill was heard yesterday too. It's a department bill dealing with the announcement if there are disclosure, of predator offenders in long term care. There was no opposition. Any questions? Do you have any comments on the A14 amendment?
I would accept the amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same. Oops. Motion prevails.
And, Madam Chair, now that we've addressed the amendments, except the one that staff is still working on to delete the sections, it would be appropriate for Representative Tamar to talk about the one section of the bill that we have not yet heard, so that we can say that we have heard every provision within this bill, within this committee. So I'd like to request Representative Paymar to talk about his provision.
Representative Paymar.
This provision, basically it allows the judges of a district court at, that the chief judge of a district court may appoint one or more suitable persons to act as referees in conciliation court. We heard this bill in Representative Mullery's committee, and this is currently being done in the 2nd and 4th district. And we heard from someone who acts as a referee in Ramsey County and testified that that referees can handle a significant amount of cases. These are conciliation court cases like unpaid debts, unpaid wages, security deposits, etc. And the hope is that this would save money in the long run. Referees are considered state employees and are paid about $75 a day. However, some do actually waive these payments. And so it's worked well in both those counties, and this would just allow it to go statewide, assuming the chief judge and the court agrees that this would be a good thing in their judicial district.
Members, Representative Hillstrom, thank you, members. Rather than this being drafted as an amendment, it was actually placed in Article 3, Section 2, members. That's why we're doing it this way. And Representative Hamer, I just want to clarify that it will save judge time. It's not going to save money, because if it saves money, it has to go to finance. So is that correct, Representative Hamer?
Well,
Representative Hamer.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I think the fiscal note came back saying it did not. It did not. It came back as zero, if I remember correctly. I know this is a issue of Representative Jackson wanted to, but I that's the way I understood it. Do we have the fiscal note?
Actually, Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, thank you. Representative Paymark, it did come back with a zero fiscal note.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? That would be it, Madam Chair, except we're just waiting on the amendment from staff. And so if there's any questions from members, I'd be happy to.
Any questions on the bill as amended? Representative Hillstrom, do you have any jokes or poetry?
No, but I could make some announcements while we wait.
Floor is yours.
Okay, members, I'm just going to make the announcements for what the rest of today brings while we wait for the amendment. Representative Lesh's committee is meeting at 4:30, and in the event he passes a bill out of his committee, we will be meeting at 6:15 tonight. Correct, Peter? 6:15 tonight?
6:30.
We'll be meeting at 6:30 tonight.
Do we know where, Madam Chair?
Yeah, Peter. 400 North.
400 North.
So what will happen is, if it passes out, we'll be meeting. We'll recess the committee when we're finished here to 6:30 in 400. In the event that none of the bills pass out of committee, I will send an email to members and we won't reconvene this committee. So,
Representative Paymar.
Just to proceed, though, maybe I'm wrong. If you recess, you're going to have to call us together to adjourn, aren't you?
At the end of the day, the committee is automatically adjourned in the event that you don't come back. So we don't have to technically come back, and we wouldn't have to have a quorum, so I could even go into the room and tap the gavel, and we would be adjourned if that would make members feel more comfortable. But I do believe that there's some potential that at least one bill may pass out, and so it is posted pending re-referral or pending action of the division, and so stay tuned.
All right.
Madam Chair, I think we should actually lay this over to give staff the adequate amount of time to deal with this issue. We have Representative Olin's bill that we can deal with, and it's my understanding there's going to be a motion to reconsider Representative Champion's bill.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, should we...
The Chair should lay over House File 1301.
I will lay over House File 1301 as amended. Representative Jackson, do you have a request?
I hereby move that we reconsider House File number 570 as amended to be passed to the General Register with an additional amendment.
All right, to your amendment, Representative Jack.
That is,
oh, I'm sorry. All those in favor to reconsider, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Representative Campion, rest area bill that we both defeated and did not send to the benefit.
Okay, so Representative Jackson to your amendment.
My amendment, and to be clear, this is 570 as amended, so it incorporates the earlier amendment. The new amendment is line 1.19 after 12 period to strike beginning with the word unless, and the to strike that the entire remainder of that line and line 1.20.
Members, yep, can you repeat that again?
Yes. At 1.19, there's a period after 12, I think. Without the comma?
Sorry.
Okay, you're right. To insert a period after the number 12, striking the comma and everything else after the comma on line 1.19, and striking line 1.20.
Okay. Representative Jackson, would you like to explain the amendment or make a comment about your amendment?
Well, there was some concern on the part of several of us about what we felt was an ambiguity in language unless specifically permitted, and we found that there was enough consensus among those concerned about that, that if that language were struck, we would be supportive of this bill.
All right. Any other questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment passes. And Representative Jackson, did you want to comment on the amendment or anything? Okay. Chair Paymar.
Campion.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I thought you said Paymar has a question. I'm sorry. All right, any further discussion on the bill as amendment? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Representative Campion. Looking at line 1.12 on the bill, yes, I'm just wondering if somebody pulls into a rest stop they empty pop cans or whatever they might have out of their boat trailer. What does that particular part of the bill mean to them?
Representative Campion.
Madam Chair, Representative, it simply means that they would be in violation if they do not properly dispose of things. The main notion is to make sure that things are done appropriately, so it's not adding additional cost to MnDOT and others. And wanting to keep the place safe and clean for tourists and travelers, just a positive environment. That is what they were seeking to do.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Campion, basically, they're okay as long as they put it in the receptacles the way they're supposed to. Thank you.
All right. Absolutely. Representative Mullery.
Well, Madam Chair, and unfortunately, it doesn't seem to say that. It says drain or dump, et cetera, except where receptacles are provided and designated to receive the refuse or waste. My concern is if there was testimony, as I believe, about them having big containers, the big dumpsters, and that those were only intended maybe for park personnel moving stuff from small containers to there. And so I guess I'm kind of concerned if, and I don't know if this can be reworded a little so that it, if there's a receptacle out there and I drive in and I put something in because I think it's a receptacle for me, but it's not designated as a receptacle for the public, it looks to me like under this I can be in violation because it says provided and designated. So I don't know if council, it seems to me maybe you could clear that up by some language. I just don't want people that
when I drive into these areas, if there's a receptacle there, it looks like waste in it, and I put waste in it, but it doesn't say this is okay to put waste in. Right now, that's a violation of it. Maybe you can clear it up somehow.
Okay, Representative Jackson or Representative Cass is also on the list. Does mean that it's your amendment? Maybe you want to...
As I recall from the photographs that Representative Champion brought, they do a pretty good job of actually identifying, and I think the dumpsters even said no dumping because they were supposed to be for the purpose of maintenance, and people were bringing in furniture and old appliances. And so that's my recollection, and Representative Champion can correct me if I'm wrong, but that they do clearly mark where garbage goes and where it doesn't go. Right.
Representative Jack Champion? Sorry.
Madam Chair and Representative, you accurately described and articulated what the testimony was. So it's clear, and it's really, again, this legislation or this bill is really only meant to make sure that the space is clean and it can be used by families, and we're not trying to overreach, and I think it would be very clear, so there would be no ambiguity.
Okay. Representative Cass, did you have a comment or question?
Yeah, it's really just a comment. I believe in the testimony that we did hear as well, suggestions towards the Department of Transportation to say that maybe they should lock those dumpsters. Now, I don't think that needs to be codified, but I think it was a suggestion to say that you need to make sure that once this is in statute, that you put some things in place to make sure people aren't dumping inappropriate things.
Okay. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move an oral amendment on 1.13. To place a period after the word provided and strike the remaining part of that line and also 1.14 in its entirety.
Okay. Can you repeat that, please? First.
Yes, I would move to amend by placing a period after the word provided on line 1.13, striking the remainder of 1.13 and 1.14 in its entirety.
That's it.
Or maybe we might need the semicolon.
Maybe or a colon or something.
Yeah. Numbers.
Semicolon.
Oh. Does staff have the appropriate language? You're good? Okay, Representative Jackson.
With all due respect to Representative Drazkowski, that, I believe, adds a little more confusion because if there are receptacles there, that's the problem. There's a big dumpster there, and I'm hoping that MnDOT starts locking them, but if they don't, the designation, I think, is important because it shows, you know, your garbage goes here. That's the designation, and no dumping over here. So I think the designation makes it clear where you put garbage and where you can't put garbage, and I like the designation language. You take that out and it's just receptacle, and I find that to be more ambiguous and not less.
Okay. Representative Champion, do you have any comments on the oral amendment?
Madam Chair, with due respect to the representative, I happen to agree with Representative Jackson. We want there to be receptacles, and we also want it to be clearly designated as to where things should go. And we just want to make sure that things, again, are orderly.
Okay. Any questions or concerns? Okay, seeing no further questions, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
I don't know why I say this. Motion does not prevail. Any other questions, comments? Okay, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to ask Representative Champion maybe a little more about item number two there at 1.10. It says you cannot dump household or commercial trash or rubbish into containers or anywhere else on site. So dump household, I'm thinking about the boat trailer and they got pop cans, fishing bait containers, or whatever. What does that mean for those folks?
Okay, Representative Champion, just before you go answer, Representative Gostkowski, we have already heard the bill, but just as a reminder. But please respond, Representative Champion.
Madam Chair and Representative, we provided some pictures which clearly showed the problem, which was household doors that were in the trash can area. There were toilets in the trash can area. There were things that were brought to the site of location that clearly people who travel would not travel with. And so that's the problem, and that's what this bill or legislation is really getting at. It's not getting at if people are, you know, on vacation and they're traveling and there's, you know, cartons or anything else like that. It's really when you clearly know that a commercial steel door doesn't necessarily belong in the dumpster trash can there.
Okay. Seeing no further comments, all those in, Representative Jackson, would you like to renew?
Yes, I renew my motion that House File 570, as originally amended and amended by my amendment, be passed to the general register.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 1301 be removed from the table.
Okay. Can I just move it from the table? Okay, I'll move it. Remove House File 1301 as amended from the table to be considered.
Yeah.
I actually.
I don't know. You recall it.
You recall. I recall it. I'm sorry. I recall it. I recall House File 1301 as amended. All right. From the table.
No, not from the table.
Members, you can recall it. I've been working with staff to see what section or sections could potentially be a problem, and so Jeff Diebel will let us know which section to delete. Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and members, on page 38, section 2, which begins on line 15, the only reference to a DNR or natural resources law in the delete everything amendment, and that would be the provision to delete.
Okay, so members, the motion would be to delete all of section 2 on page 38 from the bill, going up through page 30. The top of page 39, and then we would need to direct staff to renumber. Is that correct, Mr. Diebel? Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and members, that's correct.
Okay, so that would be my motion, Madam Chair. Okay. Any questions? Representative Szymanski. Oh, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and Representative Hillstrom. You're deleting the entire section, too?
That would be Representative Hill.
Okay. All right. And just need a clarification on that. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion carries. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, members. That is the bill. It's my understanding, I mean, we have had testimony on all of these bills, but it's my understanding that there are a few folks in the audience that wanted to make a comment. And so, Madam Chair, I would request a bit of, you know, leeway from the committee to permit those that may have been waiting around to make a few brief comments.
Sure. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on House File 1301 as amended? Okay. Please come to the testify table and state your name. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. My name is Thomas Plunkett. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I appreciate you taking the time to let me speak to you on this matter. As you may have guessed, we oppose these changes, and I think that the biggest reason is that these changes, if implemented, would put greater pressure on the public defender system, and that way it would cause an additional financial burden to the public defender system. That's because by removing this language, there are cases that private lawyers currently take.
Excuse me, Mr. Plunkett, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I believe you're talking about my bill. And this is about the expert witness. Just for clarification, and if you want to state what you have concerns about as far as what bill.
Sure. This is a bill that provides for limited funding for services other than counsel. So that would be for private lawyers getting expert witnesses, getting investigators, getting evaluations by medical providers for clients, things that are services that are not lawyer services. And the process is that you make an application to the trial judge for up to, I think it's $1,000 or $1,500. If you want more, you have to go up to the chief judge to the particular judicial district, and that can be delegated by the chief judge to another judge. We do not want to have those changes, and the reason is that, most importantly, I would think to you folks, is that those changes would put an additional financial burden on the public defender system, because private lawyers are not going to take a case when they know that they can't get a small amount of money to pay for some incidental expenses associated with the defense. I think that if you look at that by itself, I'm familiar with at least two cases where the public defenders have retained private counsel to take on a conflict case, and the attorney fees in those cases were in the high five figures and low six figure ranges. So I think this bill is going to end up putting a significant financial burden on the public defender's office. But more importantly, I think we should look at the average case when this comes up. I've done this several times myself. As a general practice, you ask for about $1,000, and I generally hire a private investigator. That investigator takes some witness interviews for me. Another thing that I would do is hire a psychologist or psychiatrist to perform a psychological evaluation, roughly the same cost. Two things. Hiring a private investigator means that I'm not going to become a witness in my own case. If you become a witness in your own case, you're going to be removed from the case. Again, that case is likely going to go back to the into the public defender system.
Can I ask you a question?
Certainly.
Thank you. Do you have a legal assistant or a paralegal?
I do not have a legal assistant or a paralegal. I think you're going to find most people. Actually, I have Anika who comes in on Sundays, but she's busy the rest of the week with two children. I think that would be a pretty common thing. And plus, Madam Chair, I'm not convinced that a legal assistant or a paralegal is qualified to take a witness statement, and is certainly not qualified to do a psychological assessment of a client.
Mr. Plunkett, Madam Chair. In full disclosure, I'm a paralegal.
Okay.
So, and I feel under personally qualified to take a witness statement. But we've discussed it, so I won't ask you any more questions. But just would say that you can have an assistant take a statement. Therefore, you would not become a witness in your own case.
Representative Jackson.
I don't recall if he was here last time, but Representative Bingham. I know that the sort of the highlighted case was the physician who did sexual function or something. Do we know what kind of, there was some testimony about how much Hennepin County spent, and I don't recall what that is, and I don't recall if we know what's spent anywhere else, you know, maybe statewide or some of the other big ones.
Maybe able to.
Madam Chair, Mr. Brown is in the audience. Members, we are not going to rehear all of these bills. Yes. Otherwise, we'll be here till midnight tonight. Because we're passing this bill tonight. Yes. So, please come to the table and be brief. We will take testimony, and if members would like to make motions to delete sections, make the motion. Mr. Brown.
Madam Chair, thank you. We did testimony on this. If there's a specific question about that case, I'm happy to answer that. I don't mean to be here. The amount on that particular case was in excess of $10,000.
and that was for the sexologist in that case. So with that, I'm not going to re-discuss it.
We're not going to rehear all the testimony. So if you have a few more comments, please make them, and then we're going to let others speak as well.
It's also my understanding that Mr. Brown testified. He indicated that on average there's about a every week or so, maybe $1,000 in Hennepin County specifically that is paid to services other than counsel. That means that in Hennepin County there'd be about $50,000 per year. If you assume that Hennepin County does about a third of the state prosecution, which I think is an accurate statistic, the entire figure for the state of Minnesota is probably closer to $150,000 that's provided for services other than counsel. That's how I could extrapolate that information for you, if that's helpful. I don't have any other comments, but if there were other specific questions, I'd be happy to address those. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Does anyone have a motion to delete a section? Representative Palmer.
Ma'am Chair, I'm not, I'm leave this up to you, but I guess I would. I just want to make sure that there's not going to be a problem with any of your bill having to go to the Finance Committee. So I'm looking for some guidance from you on Article 4, Section 1.
Your page, Representative Hamer.
Page 18. That the Public Defender's Office believes will have a bed impact.
Members, House File 1235 is what is in Section 1 on page 18. The Chair moves to delete Section 1. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion fails. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Hillstrom, would you like to renew your motion that House File 1301, as amended, be
recommended and
passed
and
sent to the General Register? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And we will recess to 6:30 tonight.
But I can get my.
Can you send it at 6:30? And we will take up Representative Olin. Do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chairman. First off, I'd like to recall 1442 for purposes of a couple things.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Say no. Motion prevails. Representative Olin.
Okay. The first thing I'd like to do, and I don't... Mr. Diebel, did you make extra copies of that amendment?
Mr. Diebel.
What I've done, because there was some confusion on the... wording that we had, is I put in a delete everything, which I think clarifies it better. The delete everything eliminated pages, or the whole first page of 1442, and left basically only section 4, which is on the back, and you're about to get it, so I'll wait till you get it so you can see exactly what words I did change. The words that specifically were changed were in the, on line 1.8 of the amendment, which says, who in the course of fleeing in a motor vehicle, which was there all the time, or subsequently by other means. The only words I've added are subsequently by other means. I've gotten rid of all that first page wording, which was very confusing, if you looked at it. So I'm just down to those words. The intent being only to to continue off of the motor vehicle incident, not to rewrite the statute.
Okay. Any questions on the amendment? Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment you have in front of you is drafted to the delete everything amendment that we considered for 1301. The amendment in front of you would need to be altered in the following way to draft it to represent Olensville. Namely, on page 1, line 1, you would delete 1301, comma, the delete everything amendment, and insert 1442, which is represent Olensville.
And by way of explanation, the reason for doing that is that my motion is actually going to be to send it to the Finance Committee, because there, I never checked the financial possibility that there could be a cost. So.
Okay. Representative Cornish. Representative Cornish, Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and members, just a little more housekeeping on the amendment. So on page 1, line 2, delete the parenthetical H1301DE2, close paren, and then on page 1, line 3, delete line 3 and insert the following language. Delete everything after the enacting clause and insert colon. And that should bring the amendment into form to Representative Olin's House File 1442.
Representative Olin.
And I would move that amendment.
Okay. Representative Anderson. Representative Cornish was first. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Olin, this doesn't change anything now on the previous law the way it is as far as shutting your lights off or using subterfuge, getting away in on foot and all the other things. This is just in this clause and all the other criteria still be there.
Representative Cornish, that is correct. It's to delete any confusion made by having it worded the way it was originally. So one and two still exist in the statute for this.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I was just trying to correlate this amendment with the 1442, and it's on the second page on the back side. That's why I was confused. Sorry, I got it.
All right. Any other questions regarding the amendment? Okay, Representative Olin, any final comments?
No, let's vote on the amendment first.
Okay. All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Now, having voted on the amendment, I'll move to send House File 1442 to Finance, just to make sure we do clean up if there is any financial costs existing.
Okay. Any final questions? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Sorry, I always say that. I don't know why. With that, we are recessed until 6:30.
Policy and Oversight to order. This is Thursday, March 26th. We've been in recess from this morning, or from this afternoon's hearing. Members, at the end of the hearing, Representative Kamer and I talked about the aggravated sentencing departure section that was in the Omnibus Public Safety Policy Bill. And the thought was that there was a fiscal note, and since that time, it has come to my attention that, in fact, there is not a fiscal note, that there is no cost. And so given the fact that we have already passed that bill out, I have no intention of reconsidering it. So it's my thought that I would move House File 1235 to be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Is there any discussion from members? Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, I'm glad we're going to keep aggravated sentencing thing alive. Is this something that we can put on your bill on the floor if that makes sense? Or I want to see that thing happen, get passed, and signed into law.
Representative Coles, there would always be the opportunity to offer amendments on the floor. At this point, we just want to see this. Representative Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I just, did someone
actually go to get the verification facts on the...
Yeah, Representative Anderson, I'm not certain if she's in the room. Nancy Haas, are you in the room? Somebody see if she's out in the hall. She does have a piece of paper that she has a certified copy from Sentencing Guidelines, but it has no Fed impact. I can have copies made and distributed to the committee if that's what they'd like.
Oh, Madam Chair, if she's got the paper, I'll... Oh, there she is right now.
It's my understanding that you have a certified copy, that there's no bad impact. Can you please come forward? The committee has asked about that. Could you give a copy to Representative Anderson? And do you have more copies? Okay, could you pass them out to the committee? Is there a page that could help? Or I don't know if we have pages in here tonight. Members, it's been a long day.
What's the House File?
1235. Members, this is for questions. We're not going to read, take all the testimony. So if members have questions, seeing none, do you have a comment?
Yes.
No. Thank you. All right. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 1235 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Next, Representative Dill. Representative Dill. Representative Dill. Members, House File 1238 is the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. There are two provisions within this bill that were within the jurisdiction of this committee. First is the uncased gun provision, and second is the night goggle provision. So, Representative Dill, if you would please keep your comments to either of those two provisions. If anyone has their cell phone on, that's what's interfering with the microphone. Members, there are two amendments to Representative Dill's bill. Are these there in your packet? The first amendment is the A-13 amendment. Members, this is a proposed amendment that Representative Dill and I have been working on for 2 days. Correct, Representative Dill?
Feels like longer, but it's been such a joy. Thank you very much for your indulgence.
All right. So, Representative Olin moved that House File 1238 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee, correct? With a recommended re-referral to the Environment Finance Committee. And then Representative Dill, do you move the A-13 amendment? Representative Olin moves the A-13 amendment to get the bill in the safe that the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Dill, there is also an additional amendment that we're going to add to your bill. Members, in an attempt to stop the dual fighting that was going on between Representative Dill and I, we deleted a section from the Omnibus Public Safety Bill today that was background checks for volunteer instructors. And this is the section that is applicable to the Game and Fish jurisdiction. And so Representative Dill has nicely agreed to accept the department's bill, and that is the A-14 amendment. So Representative Olin will move.
I'll make that motion.
A-14 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Dill, why don't you describe your bill, the sections that apply.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, the A-13 amendment is what I am now looking at. And this primarily has to do, first off, we allow guns, regardless of whether they're in a case or if in the future they're not in a case, whether they're on or on, against, or in a motor vehicle, have to be unloaded. So nothing is being changed in that regard. What this does do, if you look on line 2.12 of the amendment, it would allow for an uncased, unloaded, as I said earlier, firearm, excluding a pistol, in a motor vehicle while at a shooting range, and that citation 87A01 is the Shooting Range Protection Bill, and that defines what a shooting range is, subdivision 3 of 87A01. And also it says where the person has received permission to discharge from the owner or possessor of that. Also, while lawfully hunting on public or private land, or traveling to or from a site where the person intends to hunt lawfully that day or has hunted that day, there are exceptions to this 2.12 to 2.17, and that would be anywhere in the 7-county metropolitan area. So you'd have to have a gun cased anytime you're within any of the 7 counties defined under 473.121. And I think everyone here is familiar with the 7-county metros. Just for the record, I'll read the county so that there's no mistake about that. That's right, Madam Chair. I think I have it here. Yeah, I do. Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington. Those are the 7. Also, in 471, 633 is the ability of a local unit of government to promulgate an ordinance that would prohibit the discharge of a firearm. You would have to have the gun cased in any of those areas, a city, county, or township, any local unit of government. And also within the boundaries of a home rule charter or statutory city with a population of 2,500 or more. And let me give you a couple of examples in my district. It would be Ely and Two Harbors. Those would be two cities that I'm absolutely confident are in excess of 2,500 people. I'm trying to think. I don't think Silver Bay is at 2,500. But, for example, on the Iron Range, I'm just going to pick a few: Hibbing, Virginia, Eveleth, Mountain Iron. Those cities would all have 2,500. And there's many cities all around the state that have 2,500 or more. So, a city that had, let's pick my home city of Orr, a grand total of 261 people, they are a city, and they, a statutory city, and they could pass a discharge ordinance under 471-633, and you couldn't have a case firearm in that community either. It also has some other things I'm not going to go into in any detail. We just cite the 609-66, which is the school grounds. Then, in line 2.25, those sections are in the DNR statutes. They have to do with shining. You couldn't have an uncased gun while you're shining on a game refuge, and one other thing which I don't have it written down. I can't remember what it, but it's those kinds of things where having even a gun in your possession would be not under the current law. So with that, on that amendment, I think I'd stand for questions.
Questions from members? Seeing none. Oh, sorry, Representative Gail Cooley Jackson.
This is questions on the Gainsbridge Omnibus Bill.
There are three sections now that apply to our committee.
Right.
Representative Taft's bill, which we passed, the night goggles, and this
Okay, so those are the questions that you can ask about. We're not going to talk about the rest of the game of six, though. Questions for members? Seeing none, Representative Bill, is it okay if I ask for audience comments at this point, or did you want to talk about the night goggles?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. However you'd like to proceed. I'm thrilled that the public could be interested in.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Representative Mark.
So, Madam Chair, so are gun amendments now on the table?
Representative Tamar, at this point, amendments are what they are.
Okay.
With that, Representative Olin renews his motion that House File 1238, as amended,
be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a re-referral to the
Environment
Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bill. Next on the agenda, is Representative Lesh in the room? Okay. Representative Emmer? Representative Emmer? Where is he? Can somebody go and get...
right here.
We actually need to get someone to get Representative Lesh, because Representative Lesh really needs... We need to adopt his committee report. And I really think the department would prefer it if we do their five-minute bill before we do 2 hours of implied consent or whatever that might be. Representative Johnson.
He is presenting a bill right now that might take 20 minutes.
Okay.
Representative Johnson. Could I, somebody can give me a copy of the bill. I literally just heard it. I'm not a co-author on the bill, Madam Chair. We typically don't allow members of our co-authors to do that. I don't know if somebody is here who is.
Actually, if without objection from the committee, I would permit Representative Cole to present Representative Lesh's bill.
That's good.
Representative Shemansky, you're actually the vice chair of the committee. Representative Shemansky, would you like to move the committee report regarding House File 954?
Madam Chair, I move the... committee report on House File 954.
954, and Representative Manski, did it pass?
Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative. All those in favor of the committee report signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Manski or Coles, would one of you like to present Representative Lesh's bill?
Somebody have a copy of it?
I would bet the department can talk about it, so if you just want to go up there, we can have the department come and present it.
You got it?
Okay, members, this is a department bill. This also involves guns. And so, members, we want to make certain that members know that this is going to be traveling along.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Szymanski moves that House File 954, Representative Lesh's bill, be recommended to pass and be re-referred. It doesn't need to go anywhere else, right? It doesn't cost any money, right? Be recommended or be sent to the General Register.
I don't have it. We
don't have it.
No. We don't.
We'll get it. Why doesn't she describe the bill while she gets it? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. This bill does two things. It allows us to participate and share data with the National Instant Criminal Background Check data system, and then it also provides the authority to put together a petition process so that people who are denied access to purchase firearms because they are declared mentally ill can go through a process and have that relieved if in fact their mental illness has been treated and they are deemed to be not a public risk. The reason that this bill has come up is that after the Virginia Tech incident where the students and faculty were killed, the federal government passed a law that strengthens the Brady Act, and it is encouraging states to participate in the National Instant Data Check System and add a mental health component to that National Incident Criminal Background Check System. And there's a carrot and a stick approach that the federal government is using. The carrot is basically that if states do participate, they can waive the match requirements for states who apply for National Criminal History Improvement grants through the Department of Justice. The stick approach is that if states do not comply with this database, that we stand to lose a portion of our burn JAG dollars. Our reason for bringing this bill forward at this point in time is that we had asked the federal government to give us an extension because the data that we're being required to submit is rather substantial. So we asked for an extension. We were only granted a one-month extension. And so basically we have to do the initial parts of applying to be part of this database by the end of May. And passing this particular bill is part of what we are required to do in order to participate in this program.
Questions from members? Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe for staff, Chapter 253B, is that the civil commitment statute? As I read this language, my only concern is that on line 1.14, we talk about to commit the person under this chapter being mentally ill, developmentally disabled, mentally ill, or dangerous or chemically dependent. So there's actually a requirement of commitment as opposed to just the finding that you're chemically dependent, correct? Madam Chair, Ms. Beadle, is 253D, is that the civil commitment statute?
Madam Chair and members, yes, it is. And I would concur with your reading that requires a commitment.
Madam Chair, for the Madam Chair, witness, that's the intent, is that correct? We actually have to admit to be committed. As opposed to just a finding that they're chemically dependent.
Ms. Ellison.
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, yes, that's fine.
Madam Chair, then.
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, if there are questions or concerns about that, I'll deal with it as it moves on. But I'm fine. I don't have any concerns. I just want to make sure we weren't restricting somebody who, you know, there was a finding somewhere that they were chemically dependent, but that doesn't appear to be the case.
Okay. Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just got one question. I don't think it's necessarily. The question is, if we report, the information is transmitted to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. I realize it has to be. But now what happens, does anything get committed to them if the person petitions and now is all of a sudden all right according to Minnesota state law, or is the National still got this thing sitting on their record? Is there any?
Madam Chair, Representative Olin, the way it works is that if you are denied access to a firearm because of a mental illness, the person has the right to, the person is given the fact that they're disqualified, but they aren't told the reason for disqualifying, that they're disqualified from carrying the gun or purchasing the gun. But they're given a 1-800 number. Basically, they can call the national database system, and then through a process that they have, they are told the reason for their disqualification. And then we are required to set up a specific process for somebody to appeal and show that they have, in fact, completed treatment and are not a danger, and then that is removed.
I don't think I have any questions more.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, is there a time in regards to this as far as a person that has been by the court defined as being mentally ill or been committed by a court and now petitions that court, or is there a time element there involved with this?
Madam Chair, Representative, there is a process. I'm trying to find it here. Madam Chair, Representative, here's the information that I have at this time, that we must certify that the state has implemented a relief from disabilities program in order to be eligible to participate. The relief program must allow for an individual who has been adjudicated as a mental defective or has been committed to a mental institution to apply for relief from the disabilities imposed by this section. The relief program must also provide that a state court, board, commission, or other lawful authority grant a relief if it is determined. The person will not likely act in a manner that endangers public safety, and the granting of the relief would not be contrary to the public interest, and permit the person whose application is denied to file a petition with the state court of appropriate jurisdiction. However, it does not list a time frame on this. So I would imagine what would happen is the process that we would develop here in Minnesota would have such a timeline.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Szymanski renews his motion that House File 954 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Shemansky.
On behalf of Representative Lush, thank you, Madam.
All right. Representative Shemansky, would you like to move the crime victims report on House File 1305?
Madam Chair, I would like to move.
Okay, Representative Shemansky moved the Crime Victims and Criminal Records Division report regarding House File 1305, and it did pass, correct, Representative Shemansky?
It did pass.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails. Representative Emmer, are you in the room? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Keep in mind, Representative Emery, that a number of the people on this committee heard this bill in the other committee, and please tell us what we need to know within the jurisdiction of this committee.
Very quickly, Madam Chair, members, House File 1305 is basically three pieces, and rather than have Jim Cleary come up and explain it line and verse, I'll just give you the overview, and if you've got questions for him, he'll answer those. Briefly, the first part of the bill has to do with changes to the handling of DWI cases. Right now we have the implied consent proceeding, which is a civil proceeding. We have the DUI defense for a DUI charge, which is a criminal proceeding. They run in tandem or parallel, and you have the administrative license revocation immediately. What this would do is combine those. Essentially, you would turn the first-time offense into a payable potentially. You would raise the cost with incentives for someone to plead guilty to a DUI offense quickly. Once they plead guilty, then the post-conviction sanctions would kick in quickly, immediately. After that, I want to make it clear to everyone that the penalties in place right now are not being reduced. They are not going away. The second part of the bill has to do with something called a D card, which I've learned a lot about in the past few weeks. A D card is not in statute. It's in rules through the Department of Public Safety. There are some people here to tell you how it's impacted them and what it does. The third part of the bill is important from a processing or judicial standpoint. It has to do with the source code. For those of you who are familiar with the Intoxilizer 5000, is a machine that tests blood alcohol content. There is a disagreement, and there, I believe one of our testifiers might even have a case up on appeal having to do with the source code. Defendants would like to get the source code to see if the machine was in fact working properly when it gave its reading on the blood alcohol content to be able to challenge that if appropriate in court. The manufacturer, the Intoxilizer 5000, refuses to provide the source code, so it's got this entire area of law, I understand, is stressed a little bit. This has a potential solution for that that judicial issue as well. Those are the three parts of the bill. Mr. Cleary has spent hours drafting it. There has been a work group that includes a couple of the folks that are going to testify. We have a prosecutor, we have a defense attorney, and some others that would like to talk to you. Briefly, Madam Chair, that is what we're doing.
I believe Representative Tamar has a question. Representative Tamar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Emmer, I just want to make sure I understand this. I was asking staff about what the current, that if you're charged with a DWI, is, I understand, is a misdemeanor. Is that current law?
Representative Emmer.
That's my understanding under a first-time charge.
And
Representative
Tamar. Mm-hmm. Came on page 28 of the bill where you, section 19, this would then, if I understand this correctly, on page 28, line 11, this would now be a payable offense. My understanding would then be, it would then, first offense would be a petty misdemeanor, and not a misdemeanor.
Representative Paymar, the short answer to your question is yes, but I want to make it very clear that this bill would propose to take, first you've got the incentive for early plea. If you plead guilty, and by the way, it doesn't make it a payable. My understanding is it gives the option to make it a payable. We can't tell the courts that they're going to make this a payable or not, is my understanding. So it gives that option to make it a payable. It also changes it so that you can raise the fine that goes with it, Representative Tamar. And again, the short answer to your question is, upon conviction, it would become a petty misdemeanor, but the conviction for the DWI would remain on the person's record. Is my understanding, if Mr. Cleary has something to add.
Mr. Cleary,
Representative Tamar. Well, Madam Chair, I just want to make sure it sounded like you inferred that there was no change in the penalties, in the charge, and that's not true.
Representative Tamar, you know what? I'll stand corrected that technically it's not true. It's going to be a petty misdemeanor as opposed to a misdemeanor, but in reality it's true from the standpoint that the penalty itself, having a DWI conviction on your record, will remain, and I apologize for that.
Thank you.
Mr. Cleary, did you have something to add? Okay. Representative Emmer.
I have a prosecutor and a defense attorney, Jeff Sheridan and Sean Stokes, who would like to address you briefly.
Okay. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead. Keep in mind that it is after 7, and I think we just had a 2-hour hearing or so on this bill, correct? We want to make certain that those that may be on the other side have the opportunity to speak as well.
My reputation apparently precedes me, Madam Chair. I apologize in advance. I appear today. My name is Jeffrey Sheridan. I'm a resident of Eagan. I'm a criminal defense lawyer and have been for the past 22 years representing people in all sorts of criminal charges. I do, however, end up representing a large percentage of my clients are charged with DWI, and I find this area of the law fascinating. So I could talk all night, and I'm going to do my very best not to let that happen. So I do appear here today in support of Representative Emmer's bill, and the reason that I do that is that I believe it corrects a fundamental injustice that has been in place in this state for quite some time, and that is the idea that people should be punished for offenses that they have alleged to have committed long before they're ever convicted of that offense. As our current law stands, a person's driver's license is revoked at the hands of a police officer involved in the investigative process. That officer makes a determination at the conclusion of their investigation that a person is guilty and hands a notice of revocation to that person. That revocation notice becomes effective 7 days after the police officer puts that notice in the person's hands. That puts an enormous amount of power into the hands of the police. It is relatively unchecked, and I say relatively because over the course of the next 30 days after that's happened to a person, they have the right to sue the state of Minnesota to try to undo that. If they have the financial wherewithal, if they have the good sense to come and hire me, we will do just that. We will sue them within that 30 days. The problem is that a great majority of the public, a great majority of the population, doesn't have that ability. And in fact, of the roughly 40,000 DWI license revocations handed out in the state every year, 90% of those revocations become a permanent part of a driver's record simply by the passing of 31 days. 31 days after the officer puts that in their hands, it becomes a permanent part of their driving record, regardless of the outcome of the criminal case. So you can have your license revoked, have a permanent blemish saying your license was revoked and why, alcohol concentration, and actually lists the number, happen just by the passing of 30 days. Now, that in itself may not be overly offensive, except that there are DWI law also has a provision in it that says that all future charges can be enhanced based upon this revocation or upon a criminal conviction. So you could have a criminal conviction where a person is presumed innocent, tried to a jury, and then proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt through that process, used for purposes of later enhancement of a DWI charge, or simply let 31 days pass since the day a police officer puts that in the hands of the driver. And those two things are considered equal here in the state of Minnesota. That revocation is just as rock solid as any conviction obtained in a court of law. I don't support that point of view, and which is why I support, on behalf of my clients, that a person actually be entitled to what the United States and Minnesota constitutions guarantee for us, and that is that you will be presumed innocent, and that presumption will be with you unless and until the state overcomes it by proving your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And then we punish. That's the way the system is supposed to work. That is the way that 99.9% of the criminal charges in Minnesota's law works. There is one law, and only one law, where the punishment is handed out before you ever set foot into the courtroom, and that is Minnesota's DWI and implied Kaczynski.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. A quick question. Is there actually a constitutional right to be driving?
Mr. Sheridan.
Thank you. No, the right is that the representative makes reference to is the ability to drive, and that has been recognized as an important property interest, but it is so it is considered also to be a privilege. So there is regulation, and it is treated differently, and I don't mean to suggest otherwise. What I do mean to tell this committee is that, trust me when I tell you that of all of the things that happen to a person prosecuted for a DWI, the one thing, the most important thing, is that the person's ability to earn a livelihood is generally substantially diminished by the taking of the license. But the other point I want to make is that and I made a brief reference to it earlier, is that this is disproportionately targeted toward people without means. I provided in the committee, in the earlier subcommittee meeting, a copy of what a typical first-time offense citation looks like, charging the person with a DWI, and then setting forth their first court appearance, in that case scheduled 31 days after the time that the person was handed the traffic citation. That, I would like to say, is an unusual event, but it's not. The fact of the matter is that most times a person's first court appearance is scheduled outside this 30 days. So if a person comes to court for their what they believe to be their first court appearance, and they walk in and they intend to apply for the services of a public defender, the public defender sits them down, and the first thing he tells them is, you know what, you're right, we're going to win this case, or we're actually, you're going to be found not guilty. But the bad news is that regardless of what happens, you've already been convicted because this blemish has already become a permanent part of your driving record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. There are some things that I don't really want to argue with, but having heard that it's always 31 days after, I'd like to point out that I was a county attorney for 32 years, and I don't recall that the police ever scheduled somebody in court 31 days after they got the ticket. They were always before then.
I'm sorry, thank you. Sure. I'll let Mr. Stokes respond.
Mr. Stokes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Stokes. I'm an attorney at the Eckert Glamour's Briggs Wolf and Dreerling Law Firm in Stillwater. My law firm represents 13 municipalities. We prosecute for them all of their misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, petty misdemeanor cases. I would just concur with Mr. Sheridan that it is very common that, first of all, this is done by the court administrator. They make the dates available for law enforcement to assign arraignment hearings in the misdemeanor cases that are listed on the citation. It is extremely common that the first court appearance is after 30 days after the incident.
Representative Owen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Extremely common, but the way it was presented, it always happens. And I'd like to point out, in northwest Minnesota, which is rural Minnesota, you are far from telling the truth.
Representative Rosenthal. Good question.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. And thank you. And I don't seek to offend anybody, and I do spend primarily my time is spent here in the metropolitan area, so I'm very familiar with the practices here in the metropolitan area, and not so much with the rural area. There is nothing in the rules that say they have to be scheduled outside the 30 days or inside the 30 days. I'm just saying that as an anecdotal reference, oftentimes, more often than not, it's scheduled outside. The point I raise is that often by the time a person makes their first court appearance, and certainly a person without means, somebody who's seeking the services of a public defender, by the time they get into the process, oftentimes it's already too late. There is nothing they can do that's going to keep a DWI. Now, this will be an implied consent revocation, but having the same effect as a DWI on their record from appearing on their record.
Representative Cornyn.
I'll just make a quick comment. You are offending a couple people, Diddy.
I apologize.
Just on your language about when the cop picks the guy up, the cop does not find him guilty. You said the cop finds him guilty. The terminology, the cop is out there doing his or her job that the legislature has told him to do. He didn't or she didn't dream up the taking of the license. Just no big deal, but I just like you didn't say the cop finds him guilty.
Representative, thank you, and I agree with Representative Cornish on that point, too. I was going to say that, too. My question is, and I have no experience with this side, but if you have like a .09, it's your first offense.
Mm-hmm.
What if you have a ballpark figure? What's the ratio of the fact that they become careless or reckless instead of the DWI? Just out of curiosity, if maybe between the two of you, because.
Yeah, you probably have a better idea.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, it is very common, at least in the metropolitan area where I practice, and I do practice throughout the Twin Cities area, and I have cases in greater Minnesota as well, but with a low test, first-time offense, .08, .09, even .10, not uncommon at all. If a defendant would like to plead guilty to the amended charge of careless driving, that's a common option that a prosecutor would agree to. Now, this is a really important point with respect to this proposed bill, because you'll see in the bill there is a provision that has been referred to as the wet careless. What we're talking about here is that currently there's very little, if any, benefit to the defendant to plead guilty to careless driving when they're charged with a DUI because of the implied consent statute. And what I mean by that is their license is revoked independent of the outcome of the criminal case. The implied consent statute provides for the license revocation and also provides from the enhanceability or the aggravating factor that Mr. Sheridan referred to. So if you plead your DUI criminal charge down to careless driving, you still have the same penalties that you would have if you pled guilty because of the implied consent statute. So the bill provides for a change in the careless driving statute such that if a DUI defendant does plead guilty to careless driving, they still would have the license revocation. You still would have the enhanceability provision.
Thank you. I mean, I have known people that have gotten DWIs of when it was .10, and they got .11, went through the proceedings. They pled down to a careless. Their license is still revoked per the statute anyway. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, I think that in respect to Representative Cornish, if somebody is .09, they are drinking over the limit that this statute, that this legislature has enacted as that's our blood alcohol level. But my point is that a lot of the first-time offenders that we are worried about getting caught up in this net are able to plead to the careless driving or reckless driving, and they still have the suspended license or revocation, I mean, and they still have, I mean, I guess what I'm, I don't know, I just, I'm just saying that I think that for the first-timers, the way our system is now for that respect, I don't see much change.
Madam Chair, if I may, thank you. I understand what you're talking about, and the bill contemplates that issue. One of the criticisms of eliminating the implied consent statute is, well, what happens then with first-time offenders who have a low test? If they plead guilty to careless driving, we lose the license revocation, we lose the enhanceability or the aggravating nature of the offense, because it doesn't exist under the current careless driving statute, 16913. There's no provision to lose your license if you're convicted of careless driving. So if you don't have the corollary implied consent statute in place, you take that off the books. First time low test DUI offender pleads guilty to careless driving, there wouldn't, right, except the bill has the wet careless provision, which amends the provision
of the careless driving statute such that if you are charged with an impaired driving offense because your alcohol content was over the legal limit, no matter what the test result was, it's over the legal limit, and you plead guilty to careless driving, you still have a license revocation, you still have the enhanced ability. Which leads me to my point, and if Mr. Sheridan's not done with his testimony, obviously, defer to him. Okay, and I'll be very, very brief. I understand it's been a long day. Well, I share Mr. Sheridan's passion for DUI law. I'll be extremely brief. I'm here to testify in support of the bill for one very simple reason. There's no good reason not to. It makes perfect sense. There is no benefit at all to having the implied consent framework as it currently exists. Now, critics of this bill will argue that there is a benefit, that being the immediacy of the license revocation. Under the implied consent statute, Mr. Sheridan was talking about an officer making a decision to convict, probably a little dramatic in terms of the language, but his point, I think, is valid, which is that the officer is making the determination whether or not there's probable cause to take the driver's license. And so that happens at the time of the incident under the implied consent statute. So the offender's pulled over, they take a test, they're over the legal limit, the officer serves the notice of revocation, their license is revoked immediately. Now, critics of the bill will say that that's significant because statistics show that there's a correlation between the immediacy of the revocation and recidivism. But in practice, in reality, that's not true. Because here's the deal. Under the current statute, the day you're handed the notice of revocation, your notice of revocation also states, the same document states, you have a 7-day temporary license. So that the second you let out of jail, you're legal to drive. And you can drive for 7 days. Now, when the 7 days expires, there is a 15-day period under the current law where you can't drive, period. But when that 15 days is up, you're eligible for a work permit. So if you can go and pay the reinstatement fee and you pass the written DUI test, you can drive again. So really what we're talking about from the immediacy standpoint is 15 days. That's it. Now, the other point I would make about that is we're all assuming that repeat DUI offenders are going to obey the license revocation in the first place. Now, why is it that they would obey the license revocation but disobey the impaired driving laws? You know, I'll tell you, as a prosecutor, when I'm handling repeat DUI cases, when I'm prosecuting those cases for the state of Minnesota, it is extremely common that along with count one, DUI in the third degree or DUI in the second degree, we've got count three, DAR, driving after revocation. These people that violate the impaired driving law time and time again, they don't really respect an order from the Commissioner of Public Safety saying your license is revoked. So I think it's a myth to say we got to have the implied consent statute because we need the immediacy of the revocation. It isn't there. One more point on that. Hennepin and Ramsey County currently have a process where if the driver challenges the implied consent revocation, as Mr. Sheridan refers to it, they sue the state of Minnesota for taking away their license. Hennepin and Ramsey County will immediately reinstate their license, and their license is reinstated until their criminal case is resolved. And the reason for this has to do with Mr. Sheridan's case. This is the Fedzik decision from the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court held that the driver is entitled to have a hearing on their petition challenging the implied consent revocation within 60 days of when they file it. Well, apparently that's sort of somewhat burdensome for Hennepin and Ramsey County, so they don't want to give you your hearing within 60 days, and they won't. So what they'll do then is they'll reinstate your license. So in the two largest counties in Minnesota, there's no immediacy to the revocation under the implied consent statute at all. If you file the implied consent petition, your license is given back to you, you keep it until your criminal case is resolved.
Thank you. Technical question on this. Is it your opinion then that more people will participate in the field sobriety stuff, the breathalyzers? I mean, maybe I'm being naive about you know, the implied consent thing, but what is the, are you trying to get more people to not refuse?
What my position, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it's as simple as this. Where's the benefit to the implied consent statute? What do we gain from this process? Because I know as a prosecutor what we lose. We have law enforcement officers that are in court all the time. We've got city administrators whose budgets cannot accommodate that. If these cops aren't on duty, but they've got to go to court for the implied consent, we're paying overtime, double time, whatever it is, for cops to sit in the courtroom all day. And I'm okay with that. I mean, let's be real here. I am not a fan of impaired driving. I am absolutely fully 100% supportive of having strict, real, and, you know,
effective penalties regarding impaired driving. It's just that the implied consent law doesn't provide for that. It doesn't provide it at all. So it's an utter waste of resources. It's a waste of law enforcement resources, and it's a waste of the court's resources. And we don't derive any real benefit from it whatsoever. All of the penalties that and sanctions and consequences that the implied consent statute provides for are also incorporated in the criminal code, period. There's nothing that we get from the implied consent statute that isn't already in the criminal code. So why do we have it? Particularly in this time of budget hardship and scarcity of resources. It makes no sense.
So are more people going to do the field sobriety, in your opinion? If we repeal this, are more people going to do the breathalyzer, walk the line, whatever?
You know, I don't know that they will or won't. I really don't. But what I do know is that we don't lose anything by repealing the implied consent statute. We literally don't. And we gain quite a lot. And so, in that regard, I'm here to support it, as an attorney that does a substantial amount of work as prosecuting these cases on behalf of the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Stokes, I have a question.
Sure.
So do we gain anything by this bill if we don't make it a payable and reduce it to a petty misdemeanor?
Well, I think that we would, but I also support the petty misdemeanor provision. This, again, gets back to the immediacy issue. The way that a payable petty misdemeanor would work is that, in the way it's structured in this bill, the defendant would have to elect to plead guilty within 30 days to take advantage of the payable provision. So we're going to get that license revocation very close in time to the impaired driving incident under that scenario. As soon as they send in their check, they plead guilty, now we can revoke their license. So again, the argument that, well, we can't wait for the criminal case to conclude because then it's too remote in time from the impaired driving incident. That goes away. Now, one other point on that. As a prosecutor and a defense lawyer, again, I handle these cases throughout the Twin Cities and other parts of Minnesota, it doesn't matter if it's a misdemeanor or a petty misdemeanor because people don't go to jail on a first-time DUI. It doesn't happen. It literally doesn't happen. I was a full-time prosecutor in Sherburn County. Again, my firm represents 13 jurisdictions in Washington County. I represent clients all over the Twin Cities and metropolitan area. If it's a first-time DUI, there's no accident, so it's not a criminal vehicular operation type of case, you're not going to go to jail. So who cares if it's a misdemeanor or a petty misdemeanor? The penalty is the loss of the driver's license. The penalty is the aggravating or the enhanceable nature of the offense. The penalty is the fine and the reinstatement fee, all of which we maintain or is maintained in this proposed bill.
Thank you. Representative Emmer, did you have others? Because, again, this is Representative Emmer.
There's some people that have come to testify in the B-card from the long term.
Okay. Representative Emmer, let's stick to it.
Sure.
We have time for those that are in opposition to testify. Representative Cornyn.
Just a quick question on the enhancements.
Testify. Representative Cornyn.
Just a quick question on the enhancements. Is this bill doing anything to the enhancements over 2-0 or a child under 16 or railroad crossing or any of that stuff that would aggravate it? Okay.
There's nothing to be enhanced. Okay. Representative Emmer, please.
Whoever is here.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
My name is Jeremy Locksmith. A lot of people here have already heard my story. I've had 3 DWIs in a 10-year period, all of which were right at the limit of 0.10. To me, I don't think I had a drinking problem. I had a drinking and driving problem. I like to go out with my friends. I want to be out. I never want to be home. I've not had DWI in over 8 years. In that time frame, I had the B card. Working as an auto mechanic, which is the only trade I know, is very hard to find jobs with that restriction on there. It also prevented me from being on the Philly Fire Department since they won't allow anybody that has a restricted license. On October 25th, I was followed a couple miles and pulled over. For the officer that allowed exhaust. I was pulled over for driving, for no driving reasons or no illegal activity. He had asked me if I'd been drinking, and I told him yes. He gave me all field sobriety tests. I passed all them. He gave me a breath test. I passed that. He proceeded to give me a citation for the B-card violation. and impounded my truck. At that point in time, I believe that he profiled me, just read the license plate, and saw I had a B card, and proceeded to pull me over for that simple reason alone. He said he's supposed to take me to jail since this is a gross misdemeanor offense of a B card, but he had bigger fish to fry, so he gave me a ride home. My license was taken from me for 3 years. I received a $1,000 fine, all stayed but $200 plus fees. 160 days in jail, all stayed but 20 days. I received a bill for probation supervision of $205, $300 for the house arrest program, and $150 to get my truck out of the impound lot. I lost my auto mechanic job the month before that in September due to cutbacks. Then, of course, the next month I lose my license, not for breaking the law, but for breaking an administrative rule. Without my license, I've had no luck finding a job as an auto mechanic, because I can't test drive cars, and of course that it affects our insurance, you know, for to hire somebody with no license. I'm a single father of a beautiful 7-year-old little girl. I can no longer drive her to church on Wednesdays or Sundays. I can't go eat lunch with her on a regular basis at school like I always did. We used to go fishing every single weekend. This year we went ice fishing twice because I couldn't get there. There will be no motorcycle rides this summer. We couldn't go to our family fun night at school because I was on house arrest. I'm on unemployment and I have no one in the house to help me with money or rides. I fought two fights to get my daughter away from her mom that is a meth addict, and now I got her and she's being punished for my past. I'm not going to sit here and tell any one of you that people don't deserve to be punished for their actions, but people don't need to be punished for life. People can change. Some people learn from the punishment. Some people grow up. Some people have children that mean the world to them that make them change, and others have other reasons. I know the things I did were wrong, and I feel that I paid my debt to society. I'd like to finish my life a normal one, the one I screwed up a long time ago. I'm 34 years old. I still have a chance to get on the fire department and to help people. I know it's hard to make laws fit everyone in every case, but the way the law stands now, it says that no one will ever change. There will always be bad. If we all work together, I think we come with laws that will allow people that have changed to continue to work to raise their kids, to support their family, and fulfill the dreams, whatever they may be. But the DWI, but still keep DWIs long and strict on the people that don't want to change. That's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative
Horner. Members of the testifier, I guess, Representative Emmer, I'd support some of your provisions of this bill, and I was giving DVS a hard time the other day about all the suspensions, but at least when you bring a testifier up, don't bring one that has 3 DWIs and he claims not to have a drinking problem and then whines about the officer picking him up for no reason. That kind of offends my sensibilities, because anybody that's been picked up for DWI 3 times has probably driven 75 times DWI before they got caught. So while I support parts of your bill and want to reform different things in the bill, I just wish before next hearing you talk to your testifiers about cops finding somebody guilty and another one picking them up for no reason, and just have a little respect for the profession.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you. And Representative Cornish, thank you very much. I just want to point out, I respect this gentleman's right to come here and tell his story. I didn't ask him to. What has happened is this bill was introduced, and we have been getting emails that you wouldn't believe the volume of people that are calling and sending emails that want to tell their story. And whether we agree with it or not, I respect that. At the last, earlier today, we had 3 people we've never met before today. And again, I respect his right to come here. I also I accept your criticism, because I understand in the line of work you do an important job, and you have experienced this firsthand. So hopefully that explanation will help. The advice is well taken.
Representative Emmer, anyone
else? If there's anyone else here to testify and support, they're welcome to come up at this point. I don't know of anybody. Otherwise, we do have people here that would like to speak in opposition.
Absolutely, Representative Emmer. Questions for members, for those that are in from those that are in favor? All right, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead. Okay.
You can say for or against?
For or against.
Great. Okay.
State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Lemon. I'm a staff attorney with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association with a position that's called the Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor. This is a position that was created and is funded by the U.S. Department of Transportation. I know it's getting late and everybody wants to go home, but this is important stuff that we're doing. We have, in Minnesota, we have right here in Minnesota, 200 people killed every year in alcohol, what's classified as alcohol-related fatalities. That's every day and a half that we have somebody being killed in an alcohol-related fatality. And this bill is not proposing minor changes. These are major changes that are being proposed here. And the county attorneys have not been involved in this process until today. The full-time prosecutors have not been involved. We have Mr. Stokes, who's supposedly representing the prosecutors, who's also doing criminal defense work. And I think that we need to get everybody involved in this. I would like to, there's a number of important things here I'd like to talk about. The due process, all the constitutional challenges to the implied consent, that's been looked at numerous times over the years by our courts. They've always upheld it. As far as the revocation, the first offense would become a payable offense. There would be the person would not be put on probation. There would be no alcohol assessment done. We have an appellate case in this state, Supreme Court case, State v. Nordstrom, where it says if they don't have a right, if they're not represented when they're convicted, that you cannot use that for enhancement. So somebody goes into the window, they don't have an attorney, they pay it. Guess what? You're not going to be able to use that for enhancement down the road. Also, the way it's currently written, there would be an immediate revocation. So I'm concerned about somebody that has multiple offenses within a short period of time. The person that has a DWI and a week later they get picked up on a DWI. That is a public safety hazard. That's a drunk driver that we need to be concerned about. Under this bill, we would not have the license revocation, we would not have the conviction, we would not be able to enhance that subsequent DWI. I understand the purpose of the bill here is to try and streamline things, try and consolidate things, make it more efficient, and put things into the criminal case so you're not duplicating it in the implied consent. We currently allow, and it's being done in a number of cases, case-by-case basis, where they can consolidate the implied consent hearing with the omnibus hearing. In the criminal case, that's being done so that we don't duplicate our resources. As far as the vehicle forfeiture goes, they've taken all of the judicial. If you look at line 22.
On page.
I think it's page 21. Dealing with the judicial review of the forfeiture. That is being taken out. So if you have an instance where you have the DWI offender does not own the vehicle, it's owned by somebody else, they want to claim the innocent owner defense, which is still in the statute, they would not have a judicial hearing to do that. I know that they would intend that the forfeiture would become part of the criminal case. However, that owner would not be involved in the criminal case. They would not be getting their day in court to be heard to say, this person used the vehicle without my permission. I didn't know he was doing that. I didn't know he'd been drinking. I told him not to use it when he's drunk. They wouldn't get their day in court to possibly get their vehicle back.
Mr. Lemons, while you look through your notes, I actually have a question. One of the reasons why I believe that Representative Emmer has been working so hard on this issue is because implied consent hearing made the list of one of the hearings that the court is not going to do if they get a 10% cut in the judiciary. And so my question, if you know, what would the effect be
if the judicial branch stops doing implied consent hearings on implied consent law in general. Mr. Lemon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I think that there would be more modest things that we could be proposing, maybe consolidating the implied consent hearing into the criminal case. I think that could be done. I think that with this bill, I don't think that we're going to be saving any money, because I know the question was about the careless. You're not going to see that type of plea bargaining down. Prosecutors are not going to be giving people a plea to something that's not going to be enhanceable. Everything would be riding on the criminal case. The defense attorneys would be inclined to take the case to trial rather than plead to something where they know it's going to be enhanced, they're going to lose their life, and all these things are going to happen. They're going to say, well, let me just do a jury trial, roll the dice, and see what happens. If I lose, I end up in the same place anyway. So jury trials are much more expensive than implied consent hearings. So you're going to be seeing, I think you're going to be seeing more jury trials. I think that's a safe assumption. And the other thing...
A safe assumption under this bill, or a safe assumption on if the judiciary stops doing implied consent hearings? Mm-hmm. Mr. Lemon.
If they don't do implied... When somebody challenges the implied consent, they would get their license back. And until they get a hearing in court, so that person would have a valid driver's license if they challenge the implied consent.
So, but if the court says they're not going to do them, everybody's going to challenge, right? Because they'd get a valid license back the minute they knew that the court wasn't having a hearing. I mean, that's the reason we're even having this hearing at this time. The last hearing of the last committee is because when the court passed out a handout to us that said that implied consent hearings were one of the hearings that were on the list of possible things they weren't going to do, this was on it. And so that's why I'm asking.
Right. I know that, thank you, Madam Chair. I know that we're, as you said, we're working on this in the middle of the night. I would suggest that in that regard, maybe we could do something where we get the county attorneys involved, get some of these people involved that have been excluded, and come up with some ideas on what we can be doing. The Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety currently has a group called Driver's License Sanctions. They're looking at all these things. They're looking at the V-cards. They're looking at all this stuff. They have the public defenders involved. They have the county attorneys involved. They have the, they're looking at the admission interlock, all that. They got the treatment providers on board, and I think that we could wait and see what recommendations that they come up with.
So do you anticipate that the recommendations are going to come out this year, next year, or any idea?
I don't know. I know they've been working on it for the last few months, and I think that these are very broad changes that we're talking about, and I don't think that we understand what all the consequences are going to be. And I think that we need to use some caution with regard to this. And I would also just like to point out that with regard to the immediate driver's license sanctioning, every study that has been done on this, and there's numerous studies on it, one in 2007, the recidivism rate is severely impacted, that the immediate driver's license sanction makes a significant reduction in recidivism rate. So you're going to see fewer DWI cases, as those DWI offenders do not reoffend. So I think getting rid of this, you're going to see more people recidivate. You're going to see an increase in these things. And lastly, I'd like to talk a little bit about the source code, the last one that on the list that was being talked about. This has been an issue. This has been a huge issue in the state. We've had numerous cases dismissed, DWI cases just flat out dismissed over this. We are the only state in the country that has sued CMI to try to get the source code. And I think that if you wanted to try to put a dollar figure on what this issue has cost us, I honestly don't know where you would start. And I would just like to point out that I don't think that this bill does anything in that regard. It basically says that the state needs to find a company that's using an open source software source code that would become available or could be easily made available to them. And I don't think there's a single company that has open source software on the breath testing. If they did, I'm sure that the BCA and those folks that have the backlog of blood and urine tests would gladly be switching to a company that has open source software. I know that we did have a settlement agreement in that case that would have made it available to the defense attorneys. It would have been made available at CMI headquarters in Kentucky. A number of defense attorneys opposed that, including Mr. Sheridan, opposed that would have made the source code available, and that was denied, and the lawsuit goes on. So I guess I just think there's so many details here. I don't want to take up anybody else's time. I know Matt wanted to speak, but
I have a question for Representative Emmer. I think I've heard the testimony twice now. I'm just a little confused because what I heard the witness say. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you said that if you're a first time offender and you get a petty, then it's not enhanceable. It's I think what you said, and I guess my question is, it was my understanding that the revocation itself is enhanceable. So you still have a revocation, and if you have a second offense, it's still enhanceable. So that I want to make sure I understand this issue, Madam Chair. I think this is an important point, and I've heard this twice now in the last subdivision here, and I didn't understand that from my conversation with Representative Emmer. So somebody can help me out. I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, if I may, Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Coles, this argument that if you make it a petty, it's not enhanceable under the Nordstrom decision is absurd. But that the Supreme Court issued a decision in May of 2008 saying that you don't need a criminal conviction at all. Nordstrom talks about what due process you have in a criminal proceeding, and based upon that, whether you could use that conviction to aggravate a subsequent charge. You don't need a criminal conviction under current law anyway. You can have a situation where the license is revoked under the implied consent statute, the defendant has a trial in the criminal case and is found not guilty. They get a DUI charge subsequently 5 years down the road. It's going to be aggravated based on the license revocation. So this Nordstrom argument is absolutely wrong. Currently, Minnesota will use a foreign state's DUI license revocation or DUI administrative finding, whether it's a criminal case or not, to use that as an aggravating factor for a subsequent Minnesota offense. So that Nordstrom issue has been argued, and the appellate court and the Supreme Court have said it doesn't apply.
Madam Chair?
Representative Coles, but we do want to make sure that the other side gets an opportunity to testify. Representative Coles.
If it passes, Madam Chair, and it's signed into law, I know that's a big if, but and we have this new payable petty misdemeanor, what happens on the second, if somebody gets a second DWI, is it enhanceable or not? Yeah, it is.
You know what? We're going to have Jim Cleary.
Yeah, that's why I just waived it.
Yeah, that's Jim. Right. That is the same question.
Mr. Cleary.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Yes. I'm here and members.
Nonpartisan staff who works for the Minnesota House. Mr. Cleary.
Yes, we're not here to advocate for or against any bill, but we're here to try to implement the intent of the authors always when we draft your legislation. This area of law is very complicated. I've worked in it a very long time. I've learned from everybody in the room something, and I'm still learning. Certainly it's the intent of the author that a first-time DWI, any DWI, upon a plea of guilty, whether that's a plea of guilty to a DWI charge directly or a plea as a petty, which is still a plea to the DWI charge, or if it's a plea to careless under conditions of that it would be enhanceable. Now, that's the author's intent. I hope I've achieved that in the bill draft, but if not, we can do that in an amendment. And there might be other technical glitches in the bill yet. when the DWI community gets behind Representative Ember, we can improve that bill further. But so far, that really hasn't happened.
Thank you, Representative Olin. Did you get your question answered, Representative Olin?
I think I got it answered.
All right, members, we want to make certain that those that are in opposed have an opportunity to have their views heard in a fair and balanced way. So, were you finished, Mr. Olin?
Madam Chair, if I could just have a minute to talk about the last point.
Sure.
I think there's two things going on. It's the Nordstrom type of cases. You're going to have legal challenges on that. I can tell you that. We've had them. We've been dealing with that for years. Wisconsin does their first offense as an administrative thing. They don't have the right to counsel. We still see that issue being argued at our district courts and so on. You're going to have that issue coming up. The second point is the person that has the multiple offenses within a short period of time, they have an offense. They have a DWI. It's the first offense. It's a misdemeanor payable. The second offense happens a week later. At that point, they don't have a revocation. They don't have a conviction. That second offense a week later is going to be a payable, and that's a very dangerous repeat DWI offender that we need to be concerned about. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lynn Gogler, and I'm the legislative chair of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and I'm testifying in opposition to this bill as it stands. Matt has grave concerns about this bill. It has such sweeping changes to DWI law and policies without consideration of what's it really going to do, what is going to be the outcome. Right now, we are killing 200 people a year. We are injuring almost 4,000. And we are arresting 38,000. How is that going to be reduced with this bill? Most DWI policy has been carefully built upon research and best practices of the Minnesota experience and that of other states throughout the country. With all due respect, this bill comes with what I can find, no research backing, crafted by a few people, stating their opinions. I think that we think that it's going to take us back a giant step, perhaps back to the 60s when we were killing 56% of the people in total traffic related alcohol crashes. Removing ALR, which is a proven tool, will only increase crashes and recidivism in Minnesota. Currently, this law provides swift and certain penalties for DWI rather than lengthy and uncertain outcomes of criminal court actions. It is proven, it is researched. Currently, 41 states and the District of Columbia have ALR. There is a monumental amount of research proving that ALR is effective. I have never...
Can I interrupt you for just one second? ALR, your...
Administrative License Revocation.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
I've not seen any research or been presented with any research that opposes this. It also, the removal of ALR may mask first-time offenders, essentially treating them on a second offense as a first. If that happens, you now have a felony DWI law that rather than will be, I believe now it's 5 and 10, will become 6 and 10. Allowing a first-time DUI offender to pay the first offense has proven ineffective to reduce recidivism, and a petty misdemeanor sends a very bad message to the general public, and it's also very poor for public safety. Wisconsin currently has this law. And in 2007, their alcohol-related fatalities were 53% as opposed to Minnesota's of 40. They killed 332 people in the state of Wisconsin. Their population is about the size of Minnesota. Impaired driving is a very complicated issue, and we need proven methods based on research to understand why a person would drink and drive. There are methods that we can reduce drinking and driving through technology. Ignition interlock has proven to be very effective in reducing recidivism, and it's also a method that tracks a person's drinking problems. Research done by the Pacific Institute and others has shown that ignition interlock can show the likelihood of a person that will recidivate by studying their patterns. What are they drinking? How are they trying to turn on their car? Are they doing it 5 times in one day? We have to have better evaluation of people who drink and drive. And I'm not just talking about treatment for people that we believe to be alcoholics or have drinking problems. We need to look at people and understand why they're doing this. Do they have to have alcohol treatment? Are they just angry? Do they have mental problems? We need and we must assess the underlying cause of drinking and driving, and it must be research-based to reduce recidivism. Minnesota needs to have a comprehensive system of laws and policies of what is and is not working. We must pay attention to science and research to guide our changes. At least we make things worse than they already are. Without a comprehensive approach, we will do nothing to improve public safety and more likely will harm it with the ultimate result of increased death and injury. And to answer one question, I am a member of the DWI task force that was spoken about a few moments ago, and there will be recommendations by September of this year.
Great. Thank you. Anyone else? Please come to the table, state your name for the record. Go ahead.
Representative, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Certain
question.
Okay, now I missed your last name.
It's Lynn Dogler, D-O-U-G-H-L-E-R.
Thank you, Ms. Dogler. I guess kind of piggybacking off of the chair's question of the previous witness, the courts have told us that if they have budget cuts, this is one of these implied consent hearings are something that they're going to stop doing. We don't have a lot of authority as the legislature to tell them they have to do this. So I guess my question is, isn't it a better approach to try to figure out a way to modify or amend the implied consent law in light of the significant budget challenges we have, so that we don't have the courts just kind of doing this on their own? We have some citizen involvement and legislative involvement in improving the system.
Ms. Godwin.
Madam Chair and Representative Cole, first let me say I'm not an attorney. But we have two difficulties here. We have drunk driving, which is causing crashes and injuries, and we have 40% of the people reoffending. And then we have budget considerations. I believe Mr. Lemons before me made the suggestion that these hearings could be combined and that you wouldn't have to have separate hearings. I don't know how that would be done, but I would suggest that might be one method to look into. Our concern is that, and I don't mean to insult anyone, but this is a knee-jerk reaction to budget problems. We have the DWI task force. We have this bill. I testified on Senator Mueller's bill. We have a bill going through another committee on other things. We're not coordinating DWI in the state of Minnesota. We're just trying to come up with solutions as if we've taken a shotgun and see what sticks on the wall. Petty misdemeanor is speeding. Somebody that is driving drunk is likely to kill somebody, and that's something I think we want to prevent.
Madam Chair, Ms. Gogler,
yes.
Ms. Gogler, I take no offense at that at all, and I appreciate you coming here and testifying. I happen to think that Representative Emmer has some very intriguing ideas, and I think that the bill is going to see some more work before it finds its way to the floor. But I don't think that we're just throwing something up against the wall to see if it sticks. But I appreciate you coming here and sharing your views. I take no offense at any of your testimony at all. So I it's absolutely all right by me and most of the members of this committee that you're not a lawyer.
Madam Chair, thank you for that. My reference to a shotgun is that we have all these bills going through, and I am testifying on them, and I'm not seeing them be coordinated. So I'm not sure what's going to come out of all of this, and I'm not sure anybody here does, just because there is not enough coordination.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Ms. Godwin. I'm trying to recall what the stats are of the number of times that you drive drunk before you get caught.
Well over 1,000. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh. I believe they're well over 1,000 times that someone will still drive drunk and not get caught.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And can you tell me how many, the ratio of Minnesotans who have DWIs to the general population of the state? Do you know that number?
You know, I'm sorry.
I think somebody behind you has
Representative Chair.
Okay.
So actually, if you want to come to the table, state your name for the record, and talk into the microphone.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Representative Emmer, can I maybe get you to step to the side so both of those women can sit at the table and answer questions? We'll get you another chance.
Right there.
Go ahead, state your name for the record.
My name is Jean Ryan. I'm the Impaired Driving Program Coordinator in the Office of Traffic Safety. It's about 11% of the population, about 500,000 people.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I ask those questions is because with 11% of the population getting DWIs and each one driving well over 1,000 times impaired before they get caught, I would imagine there would be a lot more substantial mass carnage on our highways and alleys than there is. But I don't know, maybe the numbers are off or something. That's the reason I'm asking is because with that being the case and the direction we moved in DWI laws, I really have questions as to how effective they really are right now. And I say that as a veteran of a number of DWI cases, having prosecuted, never lost one. So I wanted to say this because I appreciate Representative Emmer bringing this forward. I'm not sure if I agree with every portion of this bill, but I think the discussion has to be had because I'm wondering if what we're doing right now is really working with the sheer number, at least supposedly on the road, of people with loaded guns floating around. If I'm driving home tonight, I'm passing, based on those numbers, probably every third person who's going to kill me. So, and maybe that's true, maybe it's not.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just got an observation. We are actually in charge of courts in this public safety committee, and I'm hearing that there's bills on DWIs floating around all sorts of places, and this is the only one we have seen.
Representative Olin, mostly in the Senate, they actually put it in their omnibus public safety bill. I learned about it, so we're not the only one. This is just the only one in the House. Representative Emmer, full disclosure, Representative Emmer came to me with his first bill, and when I saw that it was on the list of things that the courts were going to stop doing, I didn't say, no, Representative Emmer, I wouldn't hear it. I said, what would it look like? Because, frankly, I'm very concerned if the court stops doing implied consent hearings, what that means for Minnesota. So, is there anyone else that wanted to touch on, or did you have something else you wanted to say? Okay.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I don't disagree with you that I don't think we are doing all the thing that is right. And I don't disagree with the fact that sometimes we have people that are caught in the system that can't drive, can't work, can't take care of their families. That is why Mothers Against Drunk Driving nationally is pushing ignition interlock. A person can actually be on ignition interlock, take care of their families, keep their jobs, go to work. They just can't start that car when they're drinking. And that may be one solution to the problems that we have here.
Ms. Godler, just so you know, we did pass statewide ignition interlock out of this committee.
Yeah,
Madam Chair, I appreciate that, and I note that it is a two-year pilot program that is voluntary. I'm not sure what kind of an effect that it had, but I'm certainly not against it to try something.
All right, thanks. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, kind of a comment to Representative Emmer. I'm probably going to support your bill to move on to the next step. One of the reasons is that to get people to cooperate with you and start to find a solution, because I called DPS the other day and I told them that there was rumors about these bills coming up and asked them how to work on. I went through two people and they referred me to the Attorney General's office, and I called over there and I said, these bills are coming up, how can we work on them? Well, we can work with these people. And basically the person told me they didn't have any solutions. They wanted to stick their feet where they were at. And so the only way it looks like we can get any cooperation, getting everybody to work together, is to forward your bill and make people talk to you. And I support some portions of it. I'm not too excited about the source code thing. But I think the only way we get people to actually start working with you and talking with you and find a solution to this mess, driving after suspension after suspension after suspension, is to keep it going.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question for Representative Emmer as well. Article 2 of the bill.
In front of me. Why don't you tell me what it is?
Page 20, the B card refers to course, license reinstate, and so forth. Just have a question, Representative Emmer. Would this portion of the bill supersede the agency's rules that are in place currently?
Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Would they be any less stringent than what the rules are in place?
Representative
agency right now.
Representative Emmer.
At the last committee, and we can have Jim Cleary come back up and go through it in detail. At the last committee, subject to the chair's approval, which he's not going to give. If you read it, it sounded to me like it's more onerous. I mean, you have 5 years of monitoring. It's paid for by the individual, but it also allows or provides for rehabilitation opportunities that are not available. That's my understanding.
Madam Chair, if I may just ask a couple more questions. Currently, we heard testimony from some people that have had their B cards canceled and so forth, and I just wanted to ask if the present rules are fair in terms of in location, the proximity of where the canceled license holder lives. In other words, if it's metro or rural, in a metro area, I'm thinking they have access to mass transit and so forth, the ability to get to a job and so forth. In the rural area, in the small towns where you don't have taxis and buses, do you think that's a little more cumbersome on the person who's had their license?
Representative Emmer.
Madam Chair, Representative Shemansky, I can't imagine how difficult it is for people in outstate Minnesota that do not have a driver's license. And I'm afraid, and this is a conversation that we've had, I'm afraid that they drive without a license because they have to get back and forth to work.
Representative Emmer, I want to let you know that I was up on the Iron Range and it was very cold and very winter. And we passed a law that said that you could ride one of those little scooters on the side of the road if you were a kid without a license. And I actually saw a gentleman when it was like 20 below zero driving on one of those little scooters, and come to find out he had lost his license and had a B card situation. And everyone in the town knew that that was the reason he was doing that. So they think of all sorts of creative ways to get where they need to go. Representative Paymar.
What's the motion now?
The motion is by Representative Cole. Representative Shemansky is recommending that House File 1305, as amended, which is the DE1 amendment that you have, be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. So it would be headed right to your committee, Representative Shemansky.
Yes. I said lucky yes.
Representative Emmer, let me just comment. I think you've done a lot of work on this, and I don't like, as we're taking these petty misdemeanors down to petty misdemeanors, and I voted and signed on Representative Hamar's bill, that the court, I haven't tended to like those. But I haven't been prepared to say no yet, because I am very worried about what's going to happen if the court doesn't do these hearings. I do not want implied consent as a whole to go away. And so I'm going to support moving this bill forward, but I want you to work with the people that can here today to address some of their concerns, to see if we can't have a comprehensive plan for Minnesota DWI law, because, frankly, I have seen in my life way too many crashes due to DWI, and we need to be doing some things differently to make certain that we don't let that happen in the future.
More advice well taken, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, and thanks to the committee for all of your time.
All right. Questions for members? Seeing none, Representative Shemansky renewed his motion that House File 1305 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passed. Members, we need to adopt the minutes and then we'll adjourn. Representative Cole moves the minutes of the March 25th meeting. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, we're adjourned.